Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Angie, congratulations.
Thank you. I am still stunned. Like, last night felt like a dream. I was floating for most of the evening. So it was amazing. I am so honored.
Well, thank you for coming back down to Earth and landing back where you enjoyed your victory. Winning the Waterstones Children's Book Prize, I just wondered whether, because the award is chosen by booksellers, mm-hmm. and I just wondered whether, as an American author, whether you've been at all surprised by the reaction and the way that people have taken this book to their hearts in the UK.
I have. You know, I often heard at times, oh, it's a very American story, and then you're like, is that a good thing? You know, but I'm glad to know that there's something that a lot of readers have connected with it. All over the world. It's amazing to me. So to know that even the readers here in the UK have connected with it, even though there are the cultural differences, and even though there are even slang words that are used in American slang that have a whole different meaning here, yeah. you know, it still found its audience. So I'm absolutely honored to know that. And it goes to show that books are more universal than we give them credit for being.
And there's something I think very important about this book in terms of representation. You've spoken in the past about the frustration of being a black woman who doesn't find mm-hmm. herself represented in the books that are published. Here we can point out your book, just next to this rather lovely award. But this is the Waterstones exclusive edition. But
yes.
what's really lovely about it, apart from these sprayed edges and all that sort of yeah. stuff, is that on the cover there is the face of a black girl, mm-hmm. which shouldn't be remarkable, but actually is.
Yeah.
It's not something that you see very often. Right. Do you think that, A, that's important, and, B, what do you hope that might help to unlock and to achieve of books going forwards?
Oh, it's definitely important. It's important representation-wise, and even just on a superficial scale, if a young black girl walks into a bookstore and she sees this book, or if she goes into an American bookstore and sees my American cover with a black girl on it, and she's like, wow, that's me. That does something, and it makes her want to pick it up. So if nothing else, she finally sees herself. But then when you see a book like mine on the front of the store, like it is today,
yeah.
and you see a black girl on the cover, if nothing else, hopefully it will validate black girls more so for people who aren't black girls.
Mm-hmm.
You see this young black girl on the cover, and maybe for once you'll start to think she's worthy enough to be front and center too.
Mm.
So often black girls are pushed into the background. They're forgotten about. Even when it comes to discussions about Black Lives Matter, black girls are often forgotten, but I want to show their beautiful selves because they are awesome. I feel like black girls can change the freaking world, you know. And so for me, seeing one on the cover and having that representation so that anyone who picks this book up, they will see that right on the front of the cover, that to me, that's a statement. It's a statement that says, yeah, black girls are worthy of being on the front of the book cover, at the front of the bookstore, and at the window in Waterstones.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, April 13th, 2018. So I have been told. Nothing scarier than the young adult novel, The Hate You Give, Anti-Blackness on Steroids. This week we will be starting part two of The Hate U Give and chapter 16 specifically, but just go to the beginning of part two, and that's where we're starting. The audio segment that you heard at the beginning, that was the author Angie Thomas discussing another one of the awards that she picked up for her best-selling novel. And having an interview overseas, I think that's important. One of our listeners in the UK, Stacey, talked about how Miss Thomas was brought to her job all the way over in England to talk to them. I have no idea why they needed to bring a black female author from the States about a young adult novel to come and talk to them. But at any rate, I think that's important, the global promotion of a text like this. And I want people to really think, as we read the text this week, we've read over half of the book at this point, really think what we've heard about black females, the representation of black people and black females specifically in this book. What do we think about what we have seen, what we've read so far in terms of depiction of black females, since this is a book that seems to be heavily marketed for black girls? Question. With that, we'll get started. Context of White Supremacy. This is Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give, picking up on chapter 16, audio segment number one, Context of White Supremacy. Looked at my kingdom, I was finally there to sit on my throne as the Prince of Bel-Air.
Part 2. 5 weeks after it. 16. Ms. Ofra arranged for me to do an interview with one of the national news programs today. Exactly a week before I testify before the grand jury next Monday. It's around 6 o'clock when the limo that the news program sent arrives. My family's coming with me. I doubt my brothers will be interviewed, but Seven wants to support me. Sakani claims he does too, but really he's hoping he'll get discovered somehow with all those cameras around. My parents told him about everything. As much as he gets on my nerves, it was sweet when he gave me a handmade card that said, "Sorry." Until I opened it. There was a drawing of me crying over Khalil. And I had devil horns. Sakani said he wanted it to be real. Little asshole. We all head out to the limo. Some neighbors watch curiously from their porches and yards. Mama made all of us, including Daddy, dress up like we're going to Christ Temple. Not quite Easter formal, but not diverse church casual. She says we're not going to have the news people thinking we're hood rats. So as we're walking to the car, she's all, "When we get there, don't touch anything and only speak when somebody speaks to you. It's yes, ma'am, and yes, sir, or no, ma'am, and no, sir. Do I make myself clear?" "Yes, ma'am," the three of us say. "All right now, Star," one of our neighbors calls out. I get that just about every day in the neighborhood now. Word spreading around the garden that I'm the witness. "All right now" is more than a greeting. It's a simple way people let me know they got my back. The best part, though, it's never "All right now, Big Mav's daughter who works in the store." It's always Star. We leave in the limo. I drum my fingers on my knee as I watch the neighborhood pass by. I've talked to detectives and the DA, and next week I'll talk to the grand jury. I've talked about that night so much I can repeat it back in my sleep. But the whole world will see this. My phone vibrates in my blazer pocket. A couple of texts from Chris.
"My mom wants to know what color your prom dress is. Something about the tailor needs to know ASAP."
Oh, shit. The junior-senior prom is Saturday. I haven't bought a dress. With all this Khalil stuff, I'm not sure I want to go. Mama said I need to get my mind off things. I said no. She gave me the look. So I'm going to the damn prom. This dictatorship she's on? Not cool. I text Chris back. Light blue? He responds.
"You don't have a dress yet?"
"I've got plenty of time," I write back.
just been busy. It's true. Ms. Ofra prepared me for this interview every day after school. Some days we finished early and I helped out around Just Us for Justice. Answered phones, passed out flyers, anything they needed me to do. Sometimes I listened in on their staff meetings as they discussed police reform ideas and the importance of telling the community to protest, not riot. I asked Dr. Davis if Just Us could have a roundtable discussion at Williamson, like they do at Garden High. He said he didn't see the need. Chris replies to my prom text.
Okay, if you say so. BTW, Vontae says sup. About to kill him on Madden. He needs to stop calling me Bieber, though.
After all that white boy trying to be black shit, Devontae said about Chris, lately he's at Chris's house more than I am. Chris invited him over to play Madden, and all of a sudden they're bros. According to Devontae, Chris's massive video game collection makes up for his whiteness. I told Devontae he's a video game thought. He told me to shut up. We're cool like that, though. We arrive at a fancy hotel downtown. A white guy in a hoodie waits under the awning leading up to the door. He has a clipboard under his arm and a Starbucks cup in his hand. Still, he somehow manages to open the limo door and shake our hands when we get out.
John, the producer, it's a pleasure to meet you.
He shakes my hand a second time.
And let me guess, you're a star.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for having the bravery to do this.
There's that word again, bravery. Brave people's legs don't shake. Brave people don't feel like puking. Brave people sure don't have to remind themselves how to breathe if they think about that night too hard. If bravery is a medical condition, everybody's misdiagnosed me. John leads us through all of these twists and turns, and I'm so glad I'm wearing flats. He can't stop talking about how important the interview is and how much they want to get the truth out there. He's not exactly adding to my bravery. He takes us to the hotel courtyard, where some camera operators and other show people are setting up. In the middle of the chaos, the interviewer, Diane Carey, is getting her makeup done. It's weird seeing her in the flesh and not as a bunch of pixels on TV. When I was younger, every single time I spent the night at Nana's house, she made me sleep in one of her long-ass nightgowns, say my bedtime prayers for at least 5 minutes, and watch Diane Carey's news report so I could be knowledgeable of the world. Hi! Mrs. Carey's face lights up when she sees us. She comes over. And I gotta give the makeup lady props because she follows her and keeps working like a pro. Mrs. Carey shakes our hands. Diane, so nice to meet you all. And you must be Star, she says to me. Don't be nervous. This will simply be a conversation between the two of us. The whole time she talks, some guy snaps photos of us. Yeah, this will be a normal conversation.
Star, we're thinking we could get shots of you and Diane walking and talking around the courtyard, John says. Then we'll go up to the suite and do the conversations between you and Diane. You, Diane, and Ms. Ofra, and finally, you and your parents. After that, we'll be all set.
One of the production people mics me up as John gives me a rundown of this walk-and-talk thing.
It's only a transitional shot, he says. Simple stuff.
Simple my ass. The first time, I practically power walk. The second time, I walk like I'm in a funeral processional and can't answer Mrs. Carey's questions. I never realized walking and talking required so much coordination. Once we get that right, we take an elevator to the top floor. John leads us to a huge suite. Seriously, it looks like a penthouse overlooking downtown. About a dozen people are setting up cameras and lighting. Ms. Ofra's there in one of her Khalil shirts and a skirt. John says they're ready for me. I sit in the love seat across from Mrs. Carey. I've never been able to cross my legs, for whatever reason. So that's out the question. They check my mic, and Mrs. Carey tells me to relax. Soon, the cameras are rolling.
Millions of people around the world have heard the name Khalil Harris, she says, and they've developed their own ideas of who he was.
Who was he to you? More than he may have ever realized. One of my best friends, I say. We knew each other since we were babies. If he were here, he'd point out that he was 5 months, 2 weeks, and 3 days older than me. We both chuckle at that. But that's who Khalil is. Was. Damn. It hurts to correct myself. He was a jokester. Even when things were hard, he'd somehow find some light in it. And he... My voice cracks. I know it's corny, but I think he's here. His nosy ass would show up to make sure I say the right things, probably calling me his number one fan or some annoying title that only Khalil can think of. I miss that boy. He had a big heart, I say. I know that some people call him a thug, but if you knew him, you'd know that wasn't the case at all. I'm not saying he was an angel or anything, but he wasn't a bad person. He was a... I shrug. He was a kid. She nods. He was a kid. He was a kid. What do you think about people who focus on the not-so-good aspect of him? She asks. The fact that he may have sold drugs. Ms. Ofra once said that this is how I fight, with my voice. So I fight. I hate it, I say. If people knew why he sold drugs, they wouldn't talk about him that way. Mrs. Carey sits up a little. Why did he sell them? I glance at Ms. Ofra and she shakes her head. During all our prep meetings, she advised me not to go into details about Khalil selling drugs. She said the public doesn't have to know about that. But then I look at the camera, suddenly aware that millions of people will watch this in a few days. King may be one of them. Although his threat is loud in my head, it's not nearly as loud as what Kenya said that day in the store. Khalil would defend me. I should defend him. So I gear up to throw a punch. Khalil's mom is a drug addict, I tell Mrs. Carey. Anybody who knew him knew how much that bothered him and how much he hated drugs. He only sold them to help her out of a situation with the biggest drug dealer and gang leader in the neighborhood. Miss Ofra noticeably sighs. My parents have wide eyes. It's dry snitching, but it's snitching. Anybody who knows anything about Garden Heights will know exactly who I'm talking about. Hell, if they watch Mr. Lewis's interview, they can figure it out. But hey, since King wants to go around the neighborhood lying and saying Khalil repped his set, I can let the world know Khalil was forced to sell drugs for him. His mom's life was in danger, I say. That's the only reason he'd ever do something like that. And he wasn't a gang member.
He wasn't?
No, ma'am. He never wanted to fall into that type of life. But I guess... I think about Devante for some reason. I don't understand how everyone can make it seem like it's okay he got killed if he was a drug dealer and a gangbanger. A hook, straight to the jaw.
The media? She asks.
Yes, ma'am. It seems like they always talk about what he may have said, what he may have done, what he may not have done. I didn't know a dead person could be charged in his own murder, you know? The moment I say it, I know it's my jab to the mouth. Mrs. Carey asks for my account of that night. I can't go into a lot of details. Ms. Ofra told me not to. But I tell her we did everything 115 asked and never once cussed at him like his father claims. I tell her how afraid I was. How Khalil was so concerned about me that he opened the door and asked if I was okay.
So, he didn't make a threat on Officer Cruz's life? She questions.
No, ma'am. His exact words were, "Star, are you okay?" That was the last thing he said. And I'm ugly crying, describing the moment when the shots rang out. And Khalil looked at me for the last time.
how I held him in the street and saw his eyes gloss over. I tell her 115 pointed his gun at me.
He pointed his gun at you? She asks.
Yes, ma'am. He kept it on me until the other officers arrived.
Behind the cameras, Mama puts her hand over her mouth. Fury sparks in Daddy's eyes. Ms. Ofra looks stunned. It's another jab.
See, I only told Uncle Carlos that part.
Mrs. Carey gives me Kleenex and a moment to get myself together.
Has this situation made you fearful of cops? She eventually asks.
I don't know, I say truthfully. My uncle's a cop. I know not all cops are bad. And they risk their lives, you know. I'm always scared for my uncle. But I'm tired of them assuming, especially when it comes to black people.
You wish that more cops wouldn't make assumptions about black people, she clarifies.
Right. This all happened because he,
I can't say his name,
assumed that we were up to no good because we're black and because of where we live. We were just two kids minding our business, you know? His assumption killed Khalil. It could have killed me.
A kick straight to the ribs.
If Officer Cruz were sitting here, Mrs. Carey says, what would you say to him?
I blink several times. My mouth waters, but I swallow. No way I'm gonna let myself cry or throw up from thinking about that man. If he were sitting here, I don't have enough black Jesus in me to tell him I forgive him. Instead, I'd probably punch him straight up. But Ms. Ofra says this interview is the way I fight. When you fight, you put yourself out there, not caring who you hurt or if you'll get hurt. So I throw one more blow right at 115.
I'd ask him if he wished he shot me too.
17. My interview aired yesterday on Diane Carey's Friday Night News special. This morning, John, the producer, called and said it's one of the most watched interviews in the network's history. A millionaire who wishes to remain anonymous offered to pay my college tuition. John said the offer was made right after the interview aired. I think it's Oprah, but that's just me because I've always imagined she's my fairy godmother, and one day she'll come to my house saying, "You get a car!" The network's already got a bunch of emails in support of me. I haven't seen any of them, but I received the best message in a text from Kenya. "About time you spoke out. Don't let this fame go to your head, though." The interview trended online. When I looked this morning, people were still talking about it. Black Twitter and Tumblr have my back. Some assholes want me dead. King's not too happy, either. Kenya told me he's heated that I dry snitched. The Saturday news programs discussed the interview, too, dissecting my words like I'm the president or something. This one network is outraged by my disregard for cops. I'm not sure how they got that out the interview. It's not like I was on some NWA fuck the police type shit. I simply said I'd ask the man if he wished he shot me too. I don't care. I'm not apologizing for how I feel. People can say what they want. But it's Saturday, and I'm sitting in a Rolls Royce on my way to prom with a boyfriend who isn't saying much of anything to me. Chris is more interested in his phone. "You look nice," I tell him, which he does. His black tux with a light blue vest and tie match the strapless tea-length gown I have on. His black leather Chuck Taylors are also a good match to my silver sequined ones. The dictator, aka my mom, bought my outfit. She has pretty good taste. Chris says, "Thanks, you too." But it's so robotic, like he's saying what he's supposed to and not what he wants to. And how does he know what I look like? He's barely looked at me since he picked me up from Uncle Carlos's house. I have no clue what's wrong with him. Things have been fine between us as far as I know.
now out of nowhere, he's all moody and silent. I would ask the driver to take me back to Uncle Carlos's, but I look too cute to go home. The driveway at the country club is lit with blue lights, and golden balloon arches hang over it. We're in the only Rolls Royce among a sea of limos, so of course people look when we pull up to the entrance. The driver opens the door for us. Mr. Silent climbs out first and actually helps me out. Our classmates whoop and cheer and whistle. Chris wraps his arm around my waist and we smile for pictures like everything's all good. Chris takes my hand and wordlessly escorts me inside. Loud music greets us. Chandeliers and flashing party lights light up the ballroom. Some committee decided the theme should be Midnight in Paris, so there's a huge Eiffel Tower made out of Christmas lights. Looks like just about every junior and senior at Williamson is on the dance floor. Let me say it. A Garden Heights party and a Williamson party are two very different things. At Big D's party, people nay-nayed, hit the quan, twerked and stuff. At prom, I honestly don't know what the hell some of them are doing. Lots of jumping and fist pumping and attempts at twerking. It's not bad, just different. Way different. It's weird, though. I'm not as hesitant to dance here as I was at Big D's party. Like I said, at Williamson, I'm cool by default because I'm black. I can go out there and do a silly dance move I made up, and everyone will think it's the new thing. White people assume all black people are experts on trends and shit. There's no way in hell I'd try that at a Garden Heights party, though. You make a fool of yourself one time, and that's it. Everybody in the neighborhood will know, and nobody will forget. In Garden Heights, I learn how to be dope by watching. At Williamson, I put my learned dopeness on display. I'm not even that dope, but these white kids think I am, and that goes a long way in high school politics. I start to ask Chris if he wants to dance, but he lets my hand go and heads towards some of his boys. Why did I come to prom again? Star! Somebody calls. I look around a couple of times and finally spot Maya waving at me from a table. Girlie, she says when I get there. You look good. I know Chris went crazy when he saw you. No, he nearly drove me crazy. Thanks, I say, and give her a once-over. She's wearing a pink knee-length strapless dress. A pair of sparkly silver stilettos gives her about 5 more inches of height. I applaud her for making it this far in them. I hate heels. But if anybody's looking good tonight, it's you. You clean up nice, shorty. Don't call me that, especially since she who must not be named gave me that nickname. Damn, she Voldemorted Haley. Maya, you don't have to take sides, you know. She's the one not speaking to us, remember? Haley's been on some silent treatment shit since the incident at Maya's house. I mean, damn. I call you out on something, so I'm wrong and deserve the cold shoulder? Nah, she's not guilt-tripping me like that. And when Maya admitted to Haley that she told me why Haley unfollowed my Tumblr, Haley stopped speaking to Maya, claiming she won't talk to either of us until we apologize. She's not used to both of us turning on her like this. Whatever. She and Chris can form a club for all I care. Call it the Silent Treatment League of Young Rich Brats. I'm in my feelings just a tad. I hate that Maya got pulled into it, though. Maya, I'm sorry. No need, she says. Don't know if I told you, but I brought up the cat thing to her after I told her about Tumblr. Really? Yeah, and she told me to get over it. Maya shakes her head. I'm still mad at myself for letting her say it in the first place. Yeah, I'm mad at myself, too. We get quiet. Maya nudges my side. Hey, we minorities have to stick together, remember? I chuckle. Okay, okay. Where's Ryan? Getting some snacks. He looks good tonight, if I say so myself. Where's your guy? Don't know, I say, and don't care at the moment. The beautiful thing about best friends, they can tell when you don't want to talk, and they don't push it. Maya hooks her arm through mine. Come on. I did not get dressed up to stand around. We head for the dance floor and jump and fist pump along with the rest of them. Maya takes those heels off and barefoots it. Jess, Britt, and some of the other girls from the team join us, and we make our own little dancing circle. We lose our minds when my cousin through marriage, Beyonce, comes on. I swear I'm related to Jay-Z somehow. Same last name. We have to be. We sing loudly with Cousin Bae until we almost go hoarse, and Maya and I are really into it. I may not have Khalil, Natasha, or even Haley, but I have Maya. She's enough. After 6 songs, we head back to our table, our arms draped around each other. I carry one of Maya's shoes, and the other one dangles from her wrist by the strap. Did you see Mr. Warren do the robot? Maya asks between laughs. Did I? I didn't know he had it in him. Maya stops. She looks around without looking at anything at all. Don't look, but look to the left, she mutters. The hell? Which one is it? Look to the left, she says through her teeth, but quickly. Haley and Luke are arm in arm in the entrance, posing for pictures, and I can't even throw shade. With her gold and white dress and his white tux, they're cute. I mean, just because we've got beef doesn't mean I can't compliment her, you know? I'm even happy she's with Luke. It took long enough. Haley and Luke walk in our direction, but brush right past us, her shoulder a couple of inches away from mine. She flashes a stank eye. This chick. I probably shoot one back. Sometimes I give stank eyes and don't realize I'm giving them. Yeah, that's right, Maya says to Haley's back. You better keep walking. Lord, Maya can go from 0 to 100 a little too quick. Let's get something to drink, I say, pulling her with me, before you hurt yourself. We get some punch and join Ryan at our table. He's stuffing his face with finger sandwiches and meatballs, crumbs falling onto his tux. Where y'all been? He asks. Dancing, Maya says. She steals one of his shrimp. You didn't eat all day, did you?
Nope. I was about to starve to death.
He nods at me.
What's up, black girlfriend?
We joke around about the whole only two black kids in the class are supposed to date thing. What's up, black boyfriend? I say, and steal a shrimp, too. What do you know? Chris remembers he came with somebody and walks over to our table. He says hey to Maya and Ryan, then asks me,
you want to take pictures or something?
His tone is all robotic again. On a scale of 1 to 10 on the I'm done meter, I'm at about 50. No thanks, I tell him. I'm not taking pictures with somebody who doesn't want to be here with me. He sighs.
Why do you have to have an attitude?
Me? You're the one giving me the cold shoulder.
Damn it, Star, do you want to take a fucking picture or not?
The done meter blows up. Kaboom! Blown to pieces. Hell no! Go take one and shove it up your ass! I march off, ignoring Maya's calls for me to come back. Chris follows me. He tries to grab my arm, but I snatch away and keep walking. It's dark outside, but I easily find the Rolls Royce parked along the driveway. The chauffeur isn't around, or otherwise I would ask him to take me home. I hop in the back and lock the doors. Chris knocks on the window.
Star, come on.
He puts his hands against the window like they're binoculars, and he's trying to look through the tint.
Can we talk?
Oh, now you want to talk to me?
You're the one who wouldn't talk to me.
He bows his head, pressing his forehead against the glass.
Why didn't you tell me you were the witness they've been talking about?
He asks it softly, but it's hard as a sucker punch in the gut.
He knows.
I unlock the door and scoot over. Chris climbs in next to me.
How did you find out?
I ask.
The interview. Watched it with my parents.
They didn't show my face, though.
I knew your voice, Star. And then they showed the back of you as you walked with that interview lady. And I've watched you walk away enough to know what you look like from the back, and...
I sound like a pervert, don't I?
So you knew me by my ass?
Yeah. His face goes red. But that wasn't all. Everything made sense, like how upset you got about the protest and about Khalil.
Not that that wasn't stuff to get upset about, 'cause it was, but it...
He sighs. I'm sinking here, Star. I just knew it was you.
And it was, wasn't it?
I nod.
Babe, you should have told me. Why would you keep something like that from me?
I tilt my head. Wow. I saw someone get murdered, and you're acting like a brat 'cause I didn't tell you?
I didn't mean it like that.
But you think about that for a second, I say. Tonight you could hardly say two words to me, because I didn't tell you about one of the worst experiences of my life. You ever seen somebody die?
No.
I've seen it twice.
And I didn't know that, he says. I'm your boyfriend, and I didn't know any of that.
He looks at me, the same hurt in his eyes like there was when I snatched my hands away weeks ago.
There's this whole part of your life that you've kept from me, Star. We've been together over a year now, and you've never mentioned Khalil, who you claim was your best friend, or this other person you saw die. You didn't trust me enough to tell me.
My breath catches. It's not like that.
Really? He says. Then what is it like? What are we? Just... Fresh prints and fooling around?
No. My lips tremble, and my voice is small. I can't share that part of me here, Chris.
Why not?
Because, I croak, people use it against me. Either I'm poor Star who saw her friend get killed in a drive-by, or Star the charity case who lives in the ghetto. That's how the teachers act.
Okay. I get not telling people around school, he says. But I'm not them. I would never use that against you. You once told me I'm the only person you could be yourself around at Williamson. But the truth is, you still didn't trust me.
I'm 1 second away from ugly crying. You're right. I say, I didn't trust you. I didn't want you to just see me as the girl from the ghetto.
You didn't even give me the chance to prove you wrong. I want to be there for you. You gotta let me in.
God, being two different people is so exhausting. I've taught myself to speak with two different voices and only say certain things around certain people. I've mastered it. As much as I say I don't have to choose which Star I am with Chris, maybe without realizing it, I have to an extent. Part of me feels like I can't exist around people like him. I am not gonna cry. I am not gonna cry. I am not gonna cry. Please, he says. That does it. Everything starts spilling out. I was 10. When my other friend died, I say, staring at the French tips on my nails. She was 10, too.
What was her name? He asks.
Natasha. It was a drive-by. It's one of the reasons my parents put me and my brothers in Williamson.
It was the closest they could get to protecting us a little more. They bust their butts for us to go to that school.
Chris doesn't say anything. I don't need him to. I take a shaky breath and look around.
You don't know how crazy it is that I'm even sitting in this car, I say. A Rolls freaking Royce? I used to live in the projects in a one-bedroom apartment. I shared the room with my brothers, and my parents slept on a fold-out couch.
The details of life back then are suddenly fresh.
The apartment smelled like cigarettes all the damn time, I say. Daddy smoked. Our neighbors above us and next to us smoked. I had so many asthma attacks, it ain't funny. We only kept canned goods in the cabinets because of the rats and roaches. Summers were always too hot and winters too cold. We had to wear coats inside and outside. Sometimes Daddy sold food stamps to buy clothes for us, I say. He couldn't get a job for the longest time because he's an ex-con. When he got hired at the grocery store, he took us to Taco Bell, and we ordered whatever we wanted. I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. Almost better than the day we moved out the projects.
Chris cracks a small smile. Taco Bell is pretty awesome.
Yeah. I look at my hands again. He let Khalil come with us to Taco Bell. We were struggling, but Khalil was like our charity case. Everybody knew his mama was a crackhead. I feel the tears coming. Fuck, I'm sick of this. We were real close back then. He was my first kiss, first crush. Before he died, we weren't as close anymore. I mean, I hadn't seen him in months, and I'm ugly crying. And it's killing me because he was going through so much shit. And I wasn't there for him anymore.
Chris thumbs my tears away. You can't blame yourself.
But I do, I say. I could have stopped him from selling drugs. Then people wouldn't be calling him a thug. And I'm sorry I didn't tell you. I wanted to, but everybody who knows I was in the car acts like I'm made out of glass. You treated me normal. You were my normal.
I'm an absolute mess right now. Chris takes my hand and pulls me onto his lap, so I'm straddling him. I bury my face in his shoulder and cry like a big-ass baby. His tux is wet. My makeup is ruined. Awful. I'm sorry, he says, rubbing my back. I was an ass tonight.
You were, but you're my ass.
I've been watching myself walk away. I look at him and seriously punch his arm. He laughs and the sound of it makes me laugh. You know what I mean. You're my normal, and that's all that matters. All that matters, he smiles. I hold his cheek and let my lips reintroduce themselves to his. Chris's are soft and perfect. They taste like fruit punch, too. Chris pulls back with a gentle tug to my bottom lip. He presses his forehead against mine and looks at me. I love you. The eye has appeared. My response is easy. I love you, too. Two loud knocks against the window startled us. Seven presses his face against the glass. Y'all bet not be doing nothing. The best way to get turned all the way off? Have your brother show up. Seven, leave them alone. Layla whines behind him. We were about to dance, remember? That can wait. I gotta make sure he's not getting some from my sister. You won't get any if you don't stop acting so ridiculous, she says. I don't care. Star, get out this car. I ain't playing. Chris laughs into my bare shoulder. Did your dad tell him to keep an eye on you? Knowing Daddy, probably so. He kisses my shoulder and his lips linger there a few seconds. Are we good now? I peck him back on the lips.
We're good. Good. Let's go dance.
We get out the car, and Seven yells about us sneaking off and threatens to tell Daddy. Layla pulls him back inside as he says,
And if she push out a little Chris in 9 months, we gonna have a problem, partner.
Ridiculous. Re-damn-diculous. The music is still bumping inside. I try not to laugh as Chris really does turn the nay-nay into a no-no. Maya and Ryan join us on the dance floor, and they give me these, what the hell, looks at Chris's moves. I shrug and go with it. Toward the end of a song, Chris leans down to my ear and says, I'll be right back. He disappears into the crowd. I don't think anything of it until about a minute later when his voice comes over the speakers and he's next to the DJ in the booth. Hey, everybody, he says. My girl and I had a fight earlier. Oh, Lord, he's telling all of our business. I look at my chucks and shield my face. And I wanted to do this song, our song, to show you how much I love you and care about you, Fresh Princess. A bunch of girls go, aww. His boys whoop and cheer. I'm thinking, please don't let him sing. Please. But there's this familiar boom, 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 boom. Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down, Chris raps. And I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel Air. I smile way too hard. Our song. I rap along with him, and mostly everyone joins in, even the teachers. At the end, I cheer louder than anybody. Chris comes back down, and we laugh and hug and kiss. Then we dance and take silly selfies, flooding dashboards and timelines around the world. When prom is over, we let Maya, Ryan, Jess, and some of our other friends ride with us to IHOP. Everybody has somebody on their lap. At IHOP, we eat way too many pancakes and dance to songs on the jukebox. I don't think about Khalil or Natasha. It's one of the best nights of my life.
Context of White Supremacy. That is the end of chapter 17. We'll pick up on chapter 18 for the second audio segment. Context of White Supremacy. If you have commentary you would like to share on the first audio segment, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone and you still want to join the conversation, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. The address is tinytiny.cc/1race. It is the number 1. Address again, tinytiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Once you put in that address, look on the left of the page. You'll see the link for the free VOPE line. Click the link. It will open a small window on your screen. First line, click the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again, 564-943.
final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you are comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the program. You should be able to hear us live. Same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *61. I will see your hand on the screen. We'll get you on the line and you will be able to share. I think I have a few questions this week, actually. Question reiterating. Angie Thomas, we heard her audio at the beginning. She said that she wanted specifically non-Black readers to come away from The Hate U Give with a particular appreciation. This text is supposed to validate the experience, the lives of Black girls, particularly from reading this book. Do you all think white people, since she said non-Black, I'm going to assume that we're probably talking about whites. Do you think white child, white woman, white man that you know, that you studied in your life, do you think they would read a book like The Hate U Give and have a greater appreciation for Black females, Black girls specifically? That's question number one I would like from all of the listeners. And Thomason, New York, great job. We've had a lot of folks who contributed on this one, which is why we picked this book. We did not pick this book because Gus thought this would be an enjoyable read. It's not. We picked this for other reasons. Thomason, New York sent in, they have a quiz that is for 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th graders, high school. And they have a quiz on part one. I'm just going to read one of the questions. I can send it to you if you want to see some of the other questions. You can keep in mind my question that I asked while I read this one. So the question is, this is a quote from the text. The brand new Jordans, the crisp white tees, the diamonds in his ears, when you grow up in Garden Heights, you know what bully really means. She's talking about Khalil's attire. This is Star describing Khalil's attire way back in the beginning of the book. So the question is, based on the context, there's that word again, what is the meaning of bully? And then it gives you choices that you can pick out, dealing drugs, working at Big Mav's store, taking care of his grandma and his brother Cameron. Obviously, the correct answer is B, dealing drugs, I believe, unless we have really messed things up. Dealing drugs is how he got all of this attire, keeping in mind the question that I asked for our listening audience. But you can see some of the other questions that they give. This is the quiz, I guess, that you can use in the classroom setting. Folks who dialed in, if you have questions based on what we heard in the first segment, *61, line should be open. Folks that have hands up, feel free to participate.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello, thank you for taking my call, and hello to everyone who is listening and who will listen. I just wanted to quickly go over some of the commentary from last week since I wasn't able to join in. The whole people of color or minority alliance, it kind of disgusted me, but I guess it kind of makes sense that there is a ghostwriter and not really. I think it kind of actually shows that if non-Black people are around white people and they see that they are also practicing racism, if they see that they're practicing racism against Black people, they'll kind of keep it to themselves. But in this book, it kind of almost seems like everything is forgiven, but I'm not saying that Black people don't also do that, I guess, for other non-Black, non-white people. But I also thought that was kind of, I don't know, I guess I just didn't agree with that. And I'm glad that we actually are found out that Maya is not necessarily white. She, I guess, would be quote unquote Asian, because when Star went over her house, the mom, specifically made her sound, I think, like an Asian woman would, I guess, stereotypically sound, and also the last name Chang. I think to answer the question from last week as why Mab is the favorite, is the author's favorite character. And I feel like he's controllable, and he always, and it kind of seems like, and it's kind of getting nauseating throughout the book, having to basically hear him being emasculated by the mother. And I feel like that's because he'll never really actually be able to make up for the fact of having Seven. And I kind of feel like that's, it's almost like she's torturing this black male character throughout the book. So I don't know if it's kind of, or maybe not her, but it's kind of showing like this torturous relationship that he's having to face. He really doesn't have, like other people have said, he doesn't have any authority at all. And to break down his name, and that's just supposed to make him be okay. There's no type of, you know, equality. And that's what I thought, you know, these, people, black feminists or whatever, you know, they want equality, but this doesn't kind of share that equality. And I feel like when I think of Black Lives Matter, because I know that people, they always reference, well, it was black women who started Black Lives Matter. And I guess it kind of makes me feel like, okay, well, is this kind of their way of relating it to some type of black feminist movement? But I don't know. I'll just, that's getting off, I guess, the point. And then I didn't agree with the whole, I guess, like makeup sex scene between the mother and Maverick, because, you know, she was just so happy that they no longer had to be in the hood. And that was kind of like the reward. Again, it's just like, it really seems like he's being tortured. And I don't know why it would be, the author would have Maverick be her favorite character from this week. I feel like, with the open comments, with the question that Gus asked, I feel like if nothing else, this book is kind of maybe trying to shape young black females to maybe into this being more open to relationships with racists, and also showing how if black females are actually going to act like this to young racist white males or even females now, that, you know, this, they can still be controllable. They can still have their quote unquote pro black thoughts, but still be controllable. So you don't have to worry about that. You can still sexually sewer them, and it'll be fine. The video game thought, comment I thought was another way of, if instead of emasculating, I feel like it was definitely a feminizing Devante when it came to him playing games with Chris. And one of the things that I'm really glad that I guess I'm kind of starting to understand with the different book studies is kind of putting all the book studies together. And it seems like throughout the book, they keep having Star describe bravery as psychopathic. And it made me think about the wisdom of psychopaths. And like, she's not supposed to have any type of normal reactions. Like, psychopaths are somewhat supposed to be this, you know, unemotional, be able to do things without, dangerous things without being able to think about it. And I feel like they're kind of describing what bravery, correlating bravery with psychopaths. And I guess I'll try to wrap this up. The comment about them, at the dance, with black people are supposed to be experts in entertainment, and that's basically all that we can be experts in, dancing and singing, always having to put on a show just to make white people laugh or what have you. The last thing I'll say, two things. I'm kind of getting tired of hearing, it seems like every time Chris is in the book, it's always some type of pseudo-sexual thing. She has to straddle him or kiss him and everything like that. And the last sentence, the last couple of sentences in the book where she's so happy they're at IHOP and she says, I don't think about Khalil or Natasha, and it's one of the best nights of my life. I feel like that says it all. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
For listeners, because it's like 36 million people, I think, have. Not 36 million people have bought the book, but millions of copies have been sold over a year on the New York Times young adult bestseller list. A lot of people apparently do not share your sentiments. So there might be people who are listening and saying, you know, my goodness, what is in the water in Las Vegas? You know, what exactly do you mean that that says it all just because she had a great night and was not, you know, hounded by the memories of her dead homies, Natasha and Khalil? What do you mean? What's so upsetting about that?
The thing about it is that it's like she kept even going back to when she kept saying Chris was her normal. And it's like, I don't have to think about black people. I don't have to think about racism, white supremacy or anything like that. Something about it just really disgusted me. It's like, these people are supposed to be your friends. You still were somewhat in love with Khalil, but being around these white people, being around these people who you feel that make consider you as being poor star, but that's still supposed to be one of the best nights of your life. Being around suspected racists is one of the best nights of your life. And that's the thing that really disgusts me, I guess. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
I don't know. You get to ride with a white man in a limo and top things off with pancakes. I mean, I don't know how much better it's going to get on the plantation. Other folks that we have not heard from this week, I haven't read this book, right? If I had, I don't know if we would have done this for the book club, but I'm reading it for the first time with you all. If I had read this week's segment in advance, I would have for sure had the Good Times music ready at the end. It would have been so, so fitting and a great comic relief, but missed opportunity. Maybe I'll do it for the archives. Other folks that we've not heard from, did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Heard both of you. We'll get Thomas in New York first.
Oh, thank you, Gus. Man, this is Good Times going on paperback, or probably on riding past, walking past, playing music. Oh, I was at the store. But the interview, man, that was tacky. Punched in the guts, punched in the eyes. She was hurting them with her words. It's like, you know, or also in this book, you know, this is the type of stuff that leads to a bunch of what I call fake legal outreach, you know, Gold Star, you know, like she's going to really do something. Like, these people really empathize with us. So the white readers who read this book, here you have this whole segment that we just did, and she's, going before the reporters and giving us little, you know, tears and speech and trying to make people empathize with Khalil. Now, who do you think that the readers empathize with more, especially the white readers? Was it her or poor Chris who was left in the dark behind not knowing all her trauma? I mean, it's like, oh, man, poor Chris, you know, how could you do this to me, your friend, and... You know, you saw this happen and you didn't tell me, and I'm your boyfriend, and I could just see them. Oh, poor Chris. Okay, the fist pumping. It's so funny because I saw a commercial and they're bringing back Jersey Shore, so it just fit perfectly. Maya, what is Maya's race?
I think she's Asian. I think they made references last week when they went to, when Star went to Maya and Haley's they were at Maya's house, but Haley was there too. They, I think, read a Nevada Just reference. They referenced her mother, and she was speaking in a dialect that people would say is like stereotypically Asian, I think.
Yeah, I think I do remember that. Yeah, okay. Well, first thing is, minorities don't stick together. If we did, we wouldn't have this problem. So I think that was just a play on words, like, you know, somebody else is sticking with them. That just, you know, really ticked me, because that's not the reality here. And especially with you playing the clip with people reading this from the UK. I mean, I don't know. Chinese people, Asian people, Spanish, they do not stick with black people. That does not happen. Maybe once in the blue. It isn't Saturday. Chris, to me, was practicing racism yet again. And after all the trauma and pain and tears and recalling the good time scenes and recalling all of her best friend getting killed twice, two best friends being killed in her lifetime, and living around all the the cigarette smoke from her father and all those terrible black neighbors. She gets a response out of him when she mentions Taco Bell. Oh, Taco Bell is good, isn't it? I mean, it's just like, come on. Now, Chris is the knight in shining armor. That's the turning point that the book is taking. He's going to be her backbone now. He saves the knight. He saves her life, you know. But then he looks in her eyes. He destroyed her. He looked her in her eyes in that limo and said, I love you. And I say it before. Those are the worst three words a white person could tell you. Look you in your eyes. And then he went in before the crowd and said it to everyone before they got into their song, which was the Fresh Prince theme music, which is so funny because you play that before every show. Fits so perfectly. But like I said before, those are the worst three words. Sometimes some people never break that spell. He knows her from the interview, from her ass. I mean, he's looking at her butt. I'm sorry, guys. He's looking at her buttocks, and he knows that's her. Not her voice, nothing else, just looking at her butt. And I said, man, that's crazy. I think I said this a couple of weeks ago. It doesn't seem like any of the black people in this book are interested in looking at her in any type of way. So I just thought that was just interesting. And it also feeds into the stereotype of black women have this big butt, you know. But it doesn't. One thing I know about a black woman with a big butt, black dudes pay attention to that. They're not paying attention to her. It was more soft porn. Glad the brother stepped in. Thank God. Once again, the theme music that they sing, his love song to her, is the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air music. Now, here we have a kid, a black male, who goes to school. Well, first, he leaves the ghetto. He leaves the hood, but he's getting into fights, and people are getting killed. He leaves his mother. He goes to live in Bel-Air around affluent people, white and black. He goes to an affluent school where no one practices racism, even though him and his cousin seem to be the only two black people there. And he's a clown. Everyone is serious. His cousin's serious. All the white people are serious. And he's walking around with his blazer inside out. And he's just a joke. And that's what she seems like she is to these people. You know, she can do the dance a little bit better. She's just a joke. Last thing I wanted to add, and I said it before on this very platform, this show, that the black woman has been under attack ever since. And I brought it back to ISIS, the queen mother black goddess, right? And this book is just going to lead to more of that attack. I mean, if you look at it from that point, we have black women being slammed, black girls being slammed at swimming pools, Sandra Bland, Lamisha McBride, black women in Ohio who had the cops shoot 137 times through her and her husband's car. I mean, just crime after crime of black women. And then when you turn on the TV, what you get is black women half-dressed, trying to look like white women, with all the hair, being very disrespectful. Not people you would empathize with at all. And this book is just leading to that trend. Who's going to empathize? Black women used to be the beacon of respect, even though, even in the system, it would be like, man, they still are very conservative, but now it's totally out the window. And I'll meet my line on that. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Appreciate your patience. Kwame in the Bronx, did you have commentary, sir?
Yes, Gus. Good evening to you and all the callers. Great commentary by Red in Nevada and Thomas. I just wanted to start off my commentary saying that I hate this book. I really hate this book. To answer your question, what readers would understand about black females from reading this book basically is basically that they're pitiful, like Neely Fuller Jr. would say that all non-white people are pitiful, worthy of pity. He gives a list of the what non-white people are in his book, in the United Independent Compensatory Code System Concept book. Says that black people are powerless and pitiful, primitive and ignorant, stupid and silly. And I think that basically summarizes not just black females in society, but all the characters in this book, all the black characters in the book, and black people in general, while under the system of white supremacy. I think for that to change, you know, the system has to be replaced with a system of justice. During the interview, I had a question, Gus. Is Diane, the character that's basically based on Diane Sawyer, is she a black female or a white female?
White.
Oh, wow. Oof, that makes it worse. It was her just breaking down. It's basically like black people. I was hoping that she was a black female. Her interviewing Star and having her break down on camera in front of millions of viewers. It's just like the lynching photographs and basically white people enjoying black pain, just like delectable Negro consuming black tragedy, black grief. It's like sustenance to white people under the system of white supremacy. It's like they love to see their Negroes like crying and suffering and all of that jazz. She said no snitching during the interview. I'm with you, Gus, when you say that black people don't really have a no snitching policy. The people that really have a no snitching policy are white people. I'm sorry, I'm reading my notes. Maya's friend, Star's friend Maya said when they arrived to the junior senior prom, she said that her and Star are minorities and they have to stick together. Non-white people are not minorities. We are the majority. We make up 9/10 of the global population. White people are the true minorities. I just wanted to get that in. The whole prom was just tacky and disgusting. It was really hard to listen to. White people and her interactions with Chris at the prom. I remember Neely Fuller Jr. saying how white people study black people. They study us. The white people are not ignorant about racism. They study black people more than black people realize. It's like Neely Fuller Jr. said that, you know, white people know how to make black people happy, how to make us sad, how to make us cry, how to make us laugh. They know everything about us. And Chris, he understands Star. It's like, white people are not ignorant. That's just all what I want to say. And normal, Star says normal a lot. I've mentioned that before on another episode of the book study, on one of the other nights of the book study. Normal to me, I translate that to being white and basically the system of white supremacy. It's like white people, the system, white people have trained us to see the system of white supremacy as normal, as God ordained. Like, this is how things are supposed to be. And what else? Basically, she said that night was the happiest night of her life. It's like she was able to forget Khalil and forget the other non-white child that died when she was younger. Basically, this was the night when I could forget the system of white supremacy. This is the night where, you know, I could just, you know, ignore the fact that I am a prisoner of war. I am a victim of racism, white supremacy, and this white man is making my night so great, you know. It's like white people to the rescue. one of my favorite songs, Oreo Experience. White people to the rescue. White people to the rescue. And thank you, Gus, for letting me share.
Shout to Oreo Experience, one of my favorite guests, repeat guest actually. Oreo Experience, white people to the rescue. Any folks that we've not heard from at all have commentary. If you have a hand up, line should be open.
That's right. I'm here. I'll wait.
Proceed, Mr. Demery Ford.
Yes, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. before I jump into this week, I'd like to say something about last week. There was some name calling, and I think Devontae called Chris a wigger. And I guess that's supposed to be a white nigger. And I've noticed that there was a lack of the word nigger being used in the text. I guess that that's because some of the academic books have banned it, the word, but they seem to have snuck it in there a few occasions, but not as much as what you would think. And then also the author who spoke in the book about when Star was talking to Maya, was telling her about keeping white people's secrets and saying that, describing how they were laughing off some of the racist behavior of Haley and that they should stand up and speak out. But then I noticed the author herself, when she's interviewing a lot of times with white people, she do a lot of laughing herself. And it just, it seems sort of out of context when she does it. But that's just an observation. You asked a question about if black females were reading this book, if they would, I believe it was something to the effect that they would have a positive image, the way black females are portrayed in this. And I don't think so, because what came to mind is, like one of the callers said earlier, all of the black women that have been mistreated publicly, you know, by police officers, including the elementary school teacher that was in Austin, Texas. She weighed about 115 pounds and was slammed to the ground a couple of times by police. Her name was Breon King, I believe. I saw a documentary. That documentary on what happened to her was actually up for an award. Some international film festival award I saw someplace, but it's just, you know, I'm sure that the majority, well, I'm not sure, but black females in America should be very much aware that of the danger that is present from racist, not only racist police officers, but some tragic arrangement, because it's a power structure difference there, and it's going to always be there. I thought that when Chris was talking to Star about her not telling him what had happened or that she was in the car, It's a form of practicing racism, because I haven't seen yet where he has empathized with her. And I noticed that the author was saying in one of the interviews that empathy was better than sympathy. See, white people have a very difficult time showing empathy for black people because they just don't care. And then there's some form of enjoyment from the suffering and the terrible things that happen to black people. And if we put it in a context of globally, you know, we have shootings in the streets, but like Mr. Fuller was saying earlier, There's thousands of black people that's dying every day, you know, in other parts of the country. When you look at the fact that we're, as African-Americans, being shot down in the street, is really horrible, but it's only minute compared to the suffering globally that black people are experiencing. And with that, you know, I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus, for taking the call.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demrefour. Again, our thoughts, prayers. Hope your wife is recovering well. Run up that bill for the race soldiers. Jay in St. Louis, did you have commentary, sir? Thank you for yielding the floor.
No problem. I really appreciate hearing all the callers. Thanks for taking my call and allowing me to speak. This last chapter has been terrible, like the last caller said. I can't remember his name, but yeah, it's been terrible. I hate the book as well. I took some notes, and I wanted to note. I noticed right away how, in light of her passiveness last week, the mother of Star was characterized as quite authoritarian. The words that were used to describe her actions were interesting. Star said that Mama commanded us and made us. She also said, called her a dictator, so I thought that was interesting. Speaking of, like, this book representing black women, black femininity, I think Red and Nevada was right. You know, this is an anti-black sketch of black femininity from every angle possible. But given the oversimplification that Thomas in New York brought up, the oversimplification of fighting back is collapsed into just talking to this white woman, becoming a spectacle on camera. And that type of oversimplification is interesting because as a black woman author who writes this book and is claiming for it to, you know, inspire black girls, represent black girls, for all the commodification and the mentioning of these black leaders, we haven't heard Assata Shakur's name once. I thought that was interesting. She just hasn't came up at all. I just thought that was interesting. Then I thought about Sophia Noble and her work in communication. She's academically argued that this kind of black trauma, war porn, is, like, has a negative psychological effect on us. This is media terrorism par excellence. Like, this is straight-up propaganda. And in the midst of all the chaos, the black social dysfunction, the terrible femininity, the food terrorism, they mix in the sexual exploitation that's taking place with this white guy who is, like, completely unquestioned. It's amazing how, like, uncritical they are of criticism. I don't think I've heard one, like, actual criticism of anything he's done so far. But right before they get to the, like, terrible little softcore sex scene, I think it's interesting how Chris kind of stands in for Maverick. His gender performance is often opposed to Maverick, to her dad. Like, even when they're in the car, he brings up her dad. Like, you know, your brother's watching me because your dad, you know, your dad must have did this. But, you know, she doesn't bother telling her father that she's even dating this potential genocide heir. She's just going to date him anyway, you know, has all this intimate relationships with this white guy. And I just thought that was interesting. You know, I thought it was ironic that Chris embodies her normalcy. people brought that up earlier, that Chris embodies what's normal, but it is exactly what they've tricked us into thinking is normal. That is the problem. So I just thought that was interesting. And, that's all I had to say. Thanks.
Chris, he does get criticized. I think last week he was criticized when he and Star were at Uncle Carlos's, or they might not have been at Uncle Carlos's, but he's with Star and he refers to something as a black thing. And she kind of softly chides him and says, you know, if I didn't know you or whatever, if it was a different circumstance, you know, I'd be looking at you really hard for saying that. And he apologizes. Like, it's once or twice where he does get rebuked softly, but generally he gets a smooch and all works out well in the end. Any other folks that we missed who have a hand up
commentary that they wanted to make sure that they share? Any other folks that we missed, not heard from at all?
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
And greetings to yourself and everybody. I thought that the everybody's critique was very accurate. Even if I didn't know anything about the book, I could learn just by listening to the critique of the book. I'm thinking that we could have did a better job by having the book read being Mein Kampf. Mein Kampf would have been probably been a better reading from the standpoint of someone who is admitted a white supremacist and would also admit the idea that I don't like non-white people. The white male, Chris, reminds me of a combination of quote-unquote white Jesus and a pimp as far as how he can just calm a situation with a few words, just a few words. Address me with that question again that you had.
The author, Angie Thomas, she said in the interview we heard a snippet of this week, she said that one of her goals with this book was that for non-black readers, I'm processing that as white readers, that they will read this text and they will come away with a greater appreciation, validation for the lives and experiences of black girls specifically. And the question was, do you think, based on what we've heard so far, do you think white readers of this text would finish this book and think better of black girls specifically?
Well, I'll say this to your question. There has been an effort, although that's not really the word I want to say, but that's the only thing I can think of right now. Over the past maybe 10, 15 years, through movies, such as the one where the singer, popular black female singer, she was actually playing a singer and the movie Bodyguard. That's all I have to say. And commercials, yes, commercials. Where, with commercials, you're selling either very important or very popular goods. And what you see a non-white female and a white male. And, oh, boy, they're really getting along together. And I would say this book falls right into that. It falls right into that to put the option into a lot of non-white black females' minds, being that the connection since the beginnings of racist white supremacy, the system of racist white supremacy has initiated that black males and black females are not going to get along as far as in a constructive way, collectively, to end the world of racist white supremacy. And this book falls right in line with that, to have this, even if it's not really a reality, but at least have it in my mind is, oh, I would like to find me a Chris, that type of thing. That makes it. I may be not answering your question exactly, but that's basically when I hear your question, that's what I think the race is doing with this book. Because look at who they're targeting. They're targeting young people who are physically have adult tools, as far as bodies are concerned, but at the same time is at a stage to where they're very impressionable. They could be impacted by someone of authority figure, somebody who is devious, can also be considered very slick. And they've been quite, I think I heard you use the term 36 billion people. It shows that they have been very successful. I would say there's probably going to be more books like this to come. And also they would be generated into, of course, movies, that sort of thing. So stay tuned. As far as that concern, I kind of like just had a flushed toilet from vomiting, symbolically, from hearing this. But I'll take myself through it, because there's always something to learn, even if it's not something that I would consider to be constructive. There is something to learn. Like Mr. Fuller says, the poison is a lot of poison that's going to be into things of this nature. And we certainly have came upon one of the most poisonous articles that you can read. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Retired firefighter in Florida. Are there any other callers that we've missed? Anybody that we've not heard from at all who had commentary?
Yes. Hello, Maggie.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Paula from the 712 here. Thanks for taking my call, and I was able to get caught up to where everybody else is. I wasn't able to call in on the first two or three readings. So I'm going to start from down all the way up to one. And I got black children going to an all-white school. That's a tragedy. It almost always ends up not being a good idea. And everybody wants their child to get top-notch education, and a lot of times that's where they're giving it at, where most of the white people are at, and that's not too surprising. But there has to be another way, because a black child going to a mostly white school is okay. And then I have when she told Chris the story about, all the deaths and murders that she'd been through and how poor she was and, eating potted meat and all of that stuff. When you tell white people that, for the most part, they don't feel like some type of a bad way for you. What they do is, I don't know if they run back and chee-chee and ha-ha with their white friends about what this nigga just told me they went through or whatever they do, but they don't have any type of, like, I feel bad that your family went through that. I feel, terrible that your best friend was murdered right in front of your eyes. That's not what they think, and then we don't need to do that. And there was she said something about the girl from the ghetto, like, I didn't want to do this, that, and the third, because they were going to think that I was a ghetto person. And there's nothing we can do about that. That thought is in their head. And, just take a look back at, if you need, like, a long ago example of that, you can take a look at Mr. Medgar Evers, very educated man, didn't leave the house with his pants hanging down off his butt, just a beautiful soul, and it didn't matter because he was just a nigga at the end of the day. And we can't take that away, that they're going to not look at us as like being a ghetto person or like a nigga. They're just not going to do it. And then I have Haley and Luke get, okay, so when Haley and Luke came into their dance, now she couldn't hate on her because she looked so beautiful. But I wonder if that would have been the same instance if they had been at a dance where the black children go, and if a girl came in there that she had some type of issues with, I wonder if she could have found time to hate on her, but she couldn't hate on Haley or anything because she was so beautiful in her white and gold and Luke. And then that the question was answered, that Maya is a non-white Asian. And just like everybody was saying, and a lot of us need to realize that we don't have any friends. Like Dr. Clark said, peace be upon him, you look in the mirror and that is your friend, and you don't, there's nobody that's going to have no type of, you know, camaraderie or let's get together as I'm a Latin or I'm an Asian and I'm getting beat up by white supremacy and I want to get with you as being a black person. Not to say that there was not people that would be with us, but it's just, I wouldn't sit around and wait for to try to team up with a group of Latino people or a group of Asian people and thinking that that's going to do something, because it's not. And then her friend died. She still went to the party. I question that. And it, just a question for everybody. Is Garden Heights a mythical place, or is this somewhere in a city?
The author, Angie Thomas, she said that she grew up in Mississippi, and this is loosely based on her experience of growing up in a part of Mississippi that was predominantly black, where they didn't have tons of resources and blah, blah, blah. And then she went to a really nice, predominantly white school. So this is, I don't know if the area where she lived was called Garden Heights. I'm sure that's a fictitious name, but it's loosely based on her experience growing up, she said, in many, 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 many interviews.
Okay, thanks for that, Gus. And the Jordans, the obsession with the shoes and everything. And when I hear about black people having like a shoe obsession or a clothes obsession, I wonder, does that have something to do with our ancestors, like not having shoes and clothes? Or not that they didn't have them, they were prevented from having shoes and clothes. If y'all remember back when we read The Half Has Never Been Told, how the people, they were making the men walk around with long shirts on. And notice a lot of people didn't have shoes. I know one man had to go outside barefoot, chop wood. So I'm just, I don't know if I'm not maybe getting it right, but I just think that that could have something to do with our shoes and clothes obsession. But I could be wrong. And Chris, when Chris talked to his parents about Miss Starr being black, he didn't go into it. He said, yeah, you know, I talked to my parents about it too. And she didn't ask him, you know, well, okay, well, what did you say? And what did they say? And then what did you say back? Nothing. It's just, yeah, I talked to my parents and they know you're black. And that was it. And I wish they would have went into it. And the cat for Thanksgiving, you know, that's something that the racists, they, you know, do. Oh, you eat cats or whatever. And oh, you eat mice. And then they got the YouTube videos where they're eating all type of stuff in Asia. And a good comeback for her could have been, you know, Thanksgiving, a cat for Thanksgiving. Seriously, will you and your family be sitting down at the table to eat a human? We're talking about white people here. And will Mav ever be done paying for what he did? That is, they're trying to keep it together for the family, but I feel like that's some type of toxic relationship where you got Mav, the father here, trying to do the best he can. Yeah, he made some mistakes, but just to keep throwing, I mean, that just didn't seem right to me. And I got to number one here, y'all. I don't think I would want a young person to read this book, but I'm reading the book with you all, and I'm getting good feedback. And then they haven't assigned it to any of my, I still got two students here. I got a middle schooler and a high schooler. They haven't assigned this reading to them yet, but we live in a part of Iowa where white people like really, really, really love to have sex with black people. I mean, I'm sure it's happening all over, but I live in a part where it's like they really, really love it. So I'm sure this book will be coming. I'm glad I got to read it with you all, and I'm getting great notes and feedback. And thank you for letting me speak.
Yes, ma'am. Did we get everybody who dialed in with a hand up? Is there anybody that we've not heard from at all who does have a hand up? Grand. I think we nabbed everybody. Double check and make sure. Okay, I think we got everybody, at least for the time being. I'll see if I can get in a quick comment or two. And then the audio segments this week are a little different. The first audio segment was a little shorter than normal. Second audio segment will be a little longer than normal. The chapters were just a little irregular this week. They were a little shorter, the first two that we read. Notes that I took from this week, did not enjoy this book at all. And just make sure I get this on the record, to be a black male in a system of white supremacy in radio talk show hosts, as they say, in this climate, for Black Panther to come out, Get Out to come out, and this book, The Hate U Give, all historically popular over the past year and change, all coming out at the same time, and for Gus T to hate all of them, like, wow. Like, to be in a position where you have so many Black people who adore these projects and have spent billions collectively on all of these films, and they have so much in common, and for me to loathe every single one of them, like, wow. System of white supremacy. So, notes. Even some of the things that are minute, the detail about when Sakani made the card for his sister Star, she's going to do her interview thing, and he makes her a homemade card, and she opens it, and there was a drawing of me crying over Khalil, and I had devil horns. Now, that stood out to me particularly on this week because I just had a nonsense movie. I had the television on in the background while I was doing other things. And on this particular movie, they had, I think, a grand total of three Black characters in the entire film. Two of the Black characters were named Reckless and Demon. Now, I said, now, come on. Now, race soldiers put the script together. That's the best you can do. I mean, you couldn't just be Nigger One and Nigger Two. Reckless and Demon. That was in my mind just days ago. And so then to see this and the total context, crying over Khalil, dead black male, and then we draw my sister with devil horns. Anti-black, and yes, white people will read this, yes, and have a great opinion of Black girls and Black people in general. And then she ends this by calling her brother an asshole. There was a lot of comments about Black people having Star's back. I think Maverick says this and just other random Black people. That is about as worthless as brother and sister and any of the other cliches, power to the people or anything else. These people do not have her back, and you see this all the time. If the police decide to retaliate, Daniel Holtzclaw and his crew decide they're going to go out and, you know, do whatever. These Black people are not going to be able to do anything. They don't even have their own back. In fact, her father had said that to her earlier in the book. We just saw her father laid out prone on the ground in front of his children. He doesn't even have his own back. Worthless things. I think someone talked about that earlier. I thought that whole tacky scene where Devontae and Chris are playing video games, he gets called a thought, the same, the anti-blackness. Let's see. The whole scene where she's doing the interview and describes Khalil's mom as a drug addict and everything and is thinking that she's really doing some damage just seemed really... not understanding the system of racism, white supremacy, and almost glorying in not understanding the system of racism. I think her attorney had advised her to do certain things, and she was ignoring the attorney's advice, just glorifying and not having a code to follow. Talk about those metaphors where she's thinking that she's actually doing violence, physical damage with what she's saying. Black Jesus reference again, if where she's talking about Officer 115, if Black Jesus, I don't have enough Black Jesus in me to tell him I forgive him. Instead, I'd probably punch him straight up. That just sounded corny. It just didn't sound authentic. That to me sounded like a white person trying to generate some sort of fabricated, authentic Negro rage. Like, what do the Negroes sound like when they're angry? Yeah, that's what it is. Straight up. Chapter 17, Black Twitter and Tumblr. Yeah. The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air references, again, I hadn't read this book in advance. I just play the song in the background because I assume it's going to be mentioned, and I've been right every week thus far. It looks like that's going to be the case for the rest of the book. And the longer that that goes on, the more it troubles me, because I think this week is at least the second time in the text where there's been some sort of conflict between suspected race soldier Chris and Star, and he uses the theme song from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air to smooth over the situation. I mean, wow, I know race soldiers are deceptive and have a way with words, but that's all it takes. A Will Smith rap lyric and got the niggers in line. Like, wow. I thought the line, and particularly if this is supposed to be about, you know, black girl magic, and yeah, you're going to read this and really feel some type of way about black girls, for a white man to say that I recognized you by your ass, I mean, wow. I have not taken a class on feminism in a while, so maybe I'm not understanding objectification, but that seems like a pretty textbook example. And this is supposed to be the book of Black Lives Matter. Wow. Really glad the caller brought out that point as well about Maya. This is the Asian female character in the book. She was also, it seems, hiding white people's secrets, where she knew that Haley was lying about why she unfollowed Star's Twitter account because she was posting about racism. But she didn't tell her that until later. I meant to bring that up last week. What did people think about that? But it seems like enough people remembered it and brought it up this week. Also thought that that was a very important point. Haley coming into the prom, that even though they have beef, this is the racist white chick who made the fried chicken comment and said that she was a victim last week and demanded that Star apologize for calling her racist, same white chick, all of that. And she still has the pause, but wow, she sure does look good. And I loved the comparison, the caller who said, now, if this had been a black girl that she had had a beef with, do we think she would have paused at the part to be like, wow? Because I remember the all of the brawling and beefing that started the book off between black people. And they're running from a party where there have been gunshots and a black female pauses to pop another black female upside the head. Not just, oh, wow, she sure does look cute. Wow, what a great. No, it's, oh, I'm going to knock that heifer upside the head. Like, anti-blackness. The whole code switching, I think, is really tired. It could be said that the house Negro was code switching on the plantation, but I don't really think that that's worth anything in terms of ending racism, white supremacy. I think that's one that you can maybe sell a lot of books, make a lot of money. Buckets and buckets of words does not solve one problem. And I think I will stop there. Yeah, more crackhead references. The end of this book was pretty tacky. The whole to continue to go back and forth as though we're seriously entertaining, talking, or thinking about Khalil, black lives that allegedly matter, her friends, to think that that's serious when we continually are interrupted by these softcore porn scenes with Chris. Why, and again, Chris is supposed to be a representation of what a white ally looks like. All I've heard him do is sing Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. We will stop there. The second audio segment is a little longer, so we will get started earlier. If you had additional commentary, if you didn't get to talk at all, just write it down. We're starting it now so that we will have ample time for people to share. We'll make sure you get your commentary in once the second audio segment concludes. So we're picking up. This is chapter 18, one of the worst books that I think we've read on the book club. And this is 6 years that we've been here. I can't even think of too many white people's books that I think are worse than this. I would take Rebecca Skloot's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks over this easily any day. We will get to second audio segment. Chapter 18, The Hate You Give by Angie Thomas. Context of White Supremacy.
18. On Sunday, my parents take me and my brothers on a trip. It seems like a normal visit to Uncle Carlos's house until we pass his neighborhood. A little over 5 minutes later, a brick sign surrounded by colorful shrubs welcomes us to Brook Falls. Single-story brick houses line freshly paved streets. Black kids, white kids, and everything in between play on the sidewalks and in yards. Open garage doors show all of the junk inside,
and bikes and scooters lay abandoned in yards. Nobody's worried about their stuff getting stolen in the middle of the day. It reminds me of Uncle Carlos's neighborhood, yet it's different. For one, there's no gate around it, so they're not keeping anyone out or in, but obviously people feel safe. The houses are smaller, more homey-looking, and straight up, there are more people who look like us compared to Uncle Carlos's neighborhood. Daddy pulls into the driveway of a brown brick house at the end of a cul-de-sac. Bushes and small trees decorate the yard, and a cobblestone walkway leads up to the front door.
"Come on, y'all," Daddy says.
We hop out, stretching and yawning. Those 45-minute drives aren't a joke. A chubby black man waves at us from the driveway next door. We wave back and follow my parents up the walkway. Through the glass of the front door, the house appears empty.
"Whose house is this?"
Seven asks. Daddy unlocks the door.
"Hopefully, ours."
When we go inside, we're standing in the living room. There's a strong stench of paint and polished hardwood floors. Two halls, one on each side, lead away from the living room. The kitchen is right off from the living room, with white cabinets, granite countertops, and stainless steel appliances. "We wanted you guys to see it," Mama says. "Look around." I can't lie, I'm afraid to move. "This is our house?"
"Like I said, we hope so," Daddy replies. "We're waiting for the mortgage to be approved." "Can we afford it?" Seven asks.
Mama raises an eyebrow. "Yes, we can."
"But like, down payments and stuff?"
"Seven," I hiss. "He's always in somebody's business."
"We got everything taken care of," Daddy says. "We'll rent the house in the garden out, so that's gonna help with the monthly payments. Plus,"
he looks at Mama with this sly grin that's kinda adorable, I gotta admit. "I got the nurse manager job at Markham," she says, smiling. "I start in 2 weeks."
"For real?"
I say, and Seven goes, "Whoa," while Sakani shouts, "Mama's rich!"
"Boy, ain't nobody rich," Daddy says, "calm down."
"But this helps," says Mama, "a lot."
"Daddy, you're okay with us living out here with the fake people?"
Sakani asks. "Where you get that from, Sakani?" Mama says.
"Well, that's what he always says, that people out here are fake, and that Garden Heights is real."
"Yeah, he does say that," says Seven.
I nod, "all the time." Mama folds her arms. "Care to explain, Maverick?"
"I don't say it that much."
"Yeah, you do,"
the rest of us say.
I say it a lot. I may not have been 100% right on all of this."
Mama coughs, but there's a ha hidden in it. Daddy glares at her.
"But I realize being real ain't got anything to do with where you live. The realest thing I can do is protect my family. And that means leaving Garden Heights."
"What else?" Mama questions, like he's being grilled in front of the class.
"And that living in the suburbs don't make you any less black than living in the hood."
"Thank you," she says with a satisfied smile.
"Now are y'all gonna look around or what?"
Daddy asks. Seven hesitates to move, and since he's hesitant, Sakani is too. But shoot, I want first dibs on a room. "Where are the bedrooms?" Mama points to the hall on the left. I guess Seven and Sakani realize why I asked. The three of us exchange looks. We rush for the hall. Sakani gets there first. And it's not my best moment, but I sling his scrawny butt back.
"Mommy, she threw me," he whines.
I beat Seven to the first room. It's bigger than my current room, but not as big as I want. Seven reaches the second one, looks around, and I guess he doesn't like it. That leaves the third room as the biggest one, and it's at the end of the hall.
Seven and I race for it, and it's like Harry Potter versus Cedric Diggory trying to get to the Goblet of Fire. I grab Seven's shirt, stretching it until I have a good enough grip to pull him back and get ahead of him. I beat him to the room and open the door. And it's smaller than the first one. "I call dibs!" Sakani shouts. He shimmies in the doorway of the first room, the biggest of the three. Seven and I rock, paper, scissor it for the second biggest room. Seven always goes with rock or paper, so I easily win. Daddy leaves to get lunch, and Mama shows us the rest of the house. My brothers and I have to share a bathroom again. Sakani's finally learned aim etiquette and the art of flushing, so it's fine, I guess. The master suite is on the other hallway. There's a laundry room, an unfinished basement, and a two-car garage. Mama says we'll get a basketball hoop on wheels. We can keep it in the garage, roll it in front of the house, and play in the cul-de-sac sometimes. A wooden fence surrounds the backyard, and there's plenty of space for Daddy's garden and bricks. "Bricks can come out here, right?" I ask. "Of course. We aren't going to leave him." Daddy brings burgers and fries, and we eat on the kitchen floor. It's super quiet out here. Dogs bark sometimes, but wall-rattling music and gunshots? Not happening. "So, we're going to close in the next few weeks or so," Mama says. "But since it's the end of the school year, we'll wait until you guys are out for summer to move."
"'Cause moving ain't no joke," Daddy adds.
"Hopefully we can get settled in before you go off to college, Seven," Mama says. "Plus, it gives you a chance to make your room yours, so you can have it for holidays and the summer." Sakani slurps his milkshake and says with a mouthful of froth, "Seven said he's not going to college."
Daddy says, "What?"
Seven glares at Sakani.
"I didn't say I wasn't going to college. I said I wasn't going away to college. I'm going to Central Community, so I can be around for Kenya and Lyric."
"Oh, hell no," Daddy says. "You can't be serious," says Mama. Central Community is the junior college on the edge of Garden Heights. Some people call it Garden Heights High 2.0, because so many people from Garden High go there and take the same drama and bullshit with them.
"They have engineering classes," Seven argues.
"But they don't have the same opportunities as those schools you applied to," Mama says. "Do you realize what you're passing up? Scholarships, internships. The chance for me to finally have a Seven-free life," I add, and slurp my milkshake.
"Who asked you?" Seven says.
"Yo mama." Low blow, I know, but that response comes naturally. Seven flicks a fry at me. I block it and come this close to flipping him off, but Mama says, "You bet not." And I lower my finger.
"Look, you're not responsible for your sisters," Daddy says, "but I'm responsible for you. And I ain't letting you pass up opportunities so you can do what two grown-ass people supposed to do."
"A dollar, Daddy," Sakani points out.
"I love that you look out for Kenya and Lyric," Daddy tells Seven. "But there's only so much you can do. You can choose whatever college you want, and you'll be successful. But you choose because that's where you want to be, not because you're trying to do somebody else's job. You hear me?"
"Yeah," Seven says. Daddy hooks his arm around Seven's neck and pulls him closer. Daddy kisses his temple.
"I love you, and I always got your back."
After lunch, we gather in the living room, join hands, and bow our heads.
"Black Jesus, thank you for this blessing," Daddy says. "Even when we weren't so crazy about the idea of moving."
Mama clears her throat.
"Okay, when I wasn't so crazy about the idea of moving," Daddy corrects. "You worked things out. Thank you for Lisa's new job. Please help her and continue to be with her when she does extra shifts at the clinic. Help Sakani with his end of the year tests. And thank you, Lord, for helping Seven do something I didn't, get a high school diploma.
Guide him as he chooses a college, and let him know you're protecting Kenya and Lyric. Now, Lord, tomorrow is a big day for my baby girl as she goes before this grand jury. Please give her peace and courage. As much as I want to ask you to work this case out a certain way, I know you already got a plan. I ask for some mercy, God. That's all. Mercy for Garden Heights, for Khalil's family, for Star. Help all of us through this. In your precious name.
Wait, Mama says. I peek out with one eye. Daddy does too. Mama never, ever interrupts prayer.
Baby, says Daddy. I was finishing up.
I have something to add. Lord, bless my mom, and thank you that she went into her retirement fund and gave us the money for the down payment. Help us turn the basement into a suite so she can stay here sometimes.
No, Lord, Daddy says.
Yes, Lord, says Mama.
No, Lord.
Yes.
No. Amen.
We get home in time to catch a playoffs game. Basketball season equals war in our house. I'm a LeBron fan through and through. Miami, Cleveland, it doesn't matter. I ride with him. Daddy hasn't jumped off the Lakers ship yet, but he likes LeBron. Seven's all about the Spurs. Mama's an anybody but LeBron hater, and Sakani is a whoever is winning fan. It's Cleveland versus Chicago tonight. The battle lines are drawn. Me and Daddy versus Seven and Mama. Seven jumps on that anybody but LeBron bandwagon of hateration, too. I change into my LeBron jersey. Every time I don't wear it, his team loses. Seriously, I'm not even lying. I can't wash it either. Mama washed my last jersey right before finals, and Miami lost to the Spurs. I think she did it on purpose. I take my lucky spot in the den in front of the sectional. Seven comes in and steps over me, putting his big bare foot near my face. I smack it away. Get your crusty foot out of my face.
We'll see who's joking later. Ready for a butt whooping?
You mean am I ready to give one? Yup. Mama peeks around the doorway. Munch, you want some ice cream? I gape at her. She knows I don't eat dairy products during games. Dairy gives me gas, and gas is bad luck. She grins. How about a sundae? Sprinkles, strawberry syrup, whipped cream. I cover my ears. La 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 la. Go away, LeBron hater. La 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 la. Like I said, basketball season equals war, and my family has the dirtiest tactics. Mama returns with a big bowl, shoveling ice cream into her mouth. She sits on the sectional and lowers her bowl into my face. You sure you don't want some, Munch? It's your favorite, too. Cake batter. So good. Be strong, I tell myself. But damn, that ice cream looks good. Strawberry syrup glistens on it and a big dollop of whipped cream sits pretty on top. I close my eyes. I want a championship more. Well, you aren't getting that, so you may as well enjoy some ice cream.
Ha! Seven goes. What's all this smack up in here?
Daddy asks. He takes the recliner on the sectional, his lucky spot. Sakani scurries in and sits behind me, propping his bare feet on my shoulders. I don't mind. They haven't matured and funkified yet. I was offering Munch some of my sundae, Mama says. You want some, baby?
Heck no. You know I don't eat dairy during games.
See? It's serious.
You and Seven may as well get ready for this butt-whooping Cleveland about to give y'all, says Daddy. I mean, it ain't gonna be a Kobe butt-whooping, but it's gonna be a good one.
Amen, I say, except the Kobe part. Boy, bye, Mama tells him. You're always picking sorry teams. First, the Lakers.
Hey, a three-peat ain't a sorry team, baby, and I don't always pick sorry teams,
he grins.
I picked your team, didn't I?
Mama rolls her eyes, but she's grinning too. And I hate to admit it, but they're kind of cute right now.
Yeah, she says. That's the only time you picked right.
Uh-huh, Daddy says. See, your mama played for St. Mary's basketball team, and they had a game against Garden High, my school.
And we whooped their butts, too, Mama says, licking ice cream off her spoon. Them little girls ain't have anything on us, I'm just saying.
Anyway, I'm there to watch some of the homeboys play after the girls' game, Daddy says, looking at Mama.
This is so adorable, I can't stand it.
I got there early and saw the finest girl ever, and she was playing her ass off on the court.
Tell them what you did, says Mama, although we know.
Hey, I was trying to...
Nah, tell them what you did, she says.
I tried to get your attention.
Uh-uh, Mama says, getting up. She hands me her bowl and stands in front of the TV. You were like this on the sideline, she says, and she kind of leans to the side, holding her crotch and licking her lips. We crack up. I can so see Daddy doing that, too. During the middle of a game, she says, standing there looking like a pervert, just watching me.
But you noticed me, Daddy says, right?
'Cause you looked like a fool. Then, during halftime, I'm on the bench, and he's behind me talking about, she deepens her voice,
hey, shorty, what's your name? You know you looking good out there. Can I get your number?
Dang, Pops, you didn't have any game, Seven says.
I had game, Daddy argues.
Did you get a number that night, though? Seven says.
I mean, I was working on it.
Did you get her number? I repeat Seven's question.
Nah, he admits,
and we're hollering laughing.
Man, whatever. Hate all y'all want. I eventually did something right.
Yeah, Mama admits, running her fingers through my hair. You did. By the second quarter of Cleveland versus Chicago, we're yelling and shouting at the TV. When LeBron steals the ball, I jump up and bam, he dunks it. In your face, I yell at Mama and Seven. In your face. Daddy gives me a high five and claps. That's what I'm talking about. Mama and Seven roll their eyes. I sit in my game time position, knees pulled in, right arm draped over my head and holding my left ear and my left thumb in my mouth. Don't hate, it works. Cleveland's offense and defense is on point. Let's go, Cavs! Glass shatters. Then pop, 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 pop! Gunshots. Get down, Daddy yells. I'm already down. Sekani comes down next to me, then Mama on top of us, and she wraps her arms around us. Daddy's feet thud toward the front of the house, and the hinges on the front door squeak as it swings open. Tires screech off.
Motherfuck!
Gunshots cut Daddy off. My heart stops. For a split second, I visit a world without my dad, and it doesn't seem like much of a world at all. But his footsteps rush back in.
Y'all aight?
The weight on top of me lifts. Mama says she's okay, and Sakani says he is too. Seven echoes them. Daddy's holding his Glock.
I shot at them fools, he says between heavy breaths. I think I hit a tire. Ain't never seen that car before.
Did they shoot in the house? Mama asks.
Yeah, a couple shots through the front window, he says. They threw something, too. Landed in the living room.
I head for the front. Star, get back here, Mama calls. I'm too curious and too hard-headed. Glass shards glisten all over Mama's good sofa. A brick sits in the middle of the floor. Mama calls Uncle Carlos. He gets to our house in half an hour. Daddy hasn't stopped pacing the den, and he hasn't put his Glock down. Seven takes Sekani to bed.
Mama has her arm around me on the sectional and won't let go. Some of our neighbors checked in, like Mrs. Pearl and Ms. Jones. Mr. Charles from next door rushed over, holding his own piece. None of them saw who did it. Doesn't matter who did it, it was clearly a message for me. I have this sick feeling, like I got when I ate ice cream and played in hot weather too long when I was younger. Ms. Rosalie said the heat boiled my stomach and that something cool would settle it. Nothing cool can settle this.
Did you call the police?
Uncle Carlos asks.
Hell no, says Daddy. How I know it wasn't them?
Maverick, you still should have called, Uncle Carlos says. This needs to be recorded. And they can send someone to guard the house.
Oh, I got somebody to guard the house. Don't worry about that. It definitely ain't gonna be no crooked pig who may have been behind this.
King Lords could have done this, says Uncle Carlos. Didn't you say King made a veiled threat against Star because of her interview?
I'm not going tomorrow, I say. But I have a better chance of being heard at a Drake concert.
It ain't no damn coincidence that somebody's trying to scare us the night before she testifies to the grand jury, Daddy says. That's some shit your buddies would do.
You'd be surprised at how many of us want justice in this case, says Uncle Carlos. But of course, classic Maverick, every cop is automatically a bad cop.
I'm not going tomorrow, I repeat.
I ain't say every cop is a bad cop, but I ain't gonna stand here like a fool thinking that some of them don't do dirty shit. Hell, they made me lay face down on the sidewalk, and for what? 'Cause they could.
It could have been either one of them, Mama says. Trying to figure out who did it will get us nowhere. The main thing is making sure Star is safe tomorrow.
I said I'm not going,
I shout. They finally hear me. My stomach holds a roiling boil. Yeah, it could have been King Lords, but what if it was the cops? I look at Daddy and remember that moment weeks ago in front of the store. I thought they were gonna kill you, I croak, because of me. He kneels in front of me and sits the Glock beside my feet. He lifts my chin.
Point one of the 10-point program. Say it.
My brothers and I learned to recite the Black Panther's 10-point program the same way other kids learn the Pledge of Allegiance. We want freedom, I say. We want the power to determine the destiny of our black and oppressed communities.
Say it again.
We want freedom. We want the power to determine the destiny of our black and oppressed communities.
Point seven.
We want an immediate end to police brutality, I say, and the murder of black people, other people of color, and oppressed people.
Again.
We want an immediate end to police brutality and the murder of black people, other people of color, and oppressed people.
And what did Brother Malcolm say is our objective?
Seven and I could recite Malcolm X quotes by the time we were 13. Sikani hasn't gotten there yet. Complete freedom, justice, and equality, I say. By any means necessary.
Again.
Complete freedom, justice, and equality. By any means necessary.
So why you gonna be quiet?
Daddy asks. Because the 10-point program didn't work for the Panthers. Huey Newton died a crackhead, and the government crushed the Panthers one by one. By any means necessary didn't keep Brother Malcolm from dying, possibly at the hands of his own people. Intentions always look better on paper than in reality. The reality is, I may not make it to the courthouse in the morning. Two loud knocks at the front door startle us. Daddy straightens up, grabs his Glock, and leaves to answer. He says what's up to somebody, and there's a sound like palm slapping. Then a male voice says,
"You know we got you, Big Mav."
Daddy returns with some tall, wide-shouldered guys dressed in gray and black. It's a lighter gray than what King and his folks wear. It takes a hood-trained eye to notice it,
and understand. This is a different set of king lords.
This is Goon.
Daddy points to the shortest one, in front with the ponytails.
Him and his boys gonna provide security for us tonight and tomorrow.
Uncle Carlos folds his arms and gives the king lords a hard look.
You asked king lords to guard the house when king lords may have put us in this position? They don't mess with king,
Daddy says.
They Cedar Grove king lords.
Shit. They may as well be GDs, then. Sets make all the difference in gangbanging, not colors. The Cedar Grove king lords have been beefing with King Set, the West Side king lords, for a while now.
You need us to fall back, Big Mav?
Goon asks.
Nah, don't worry about him,
Daddy says.
Y'all do what y'all came to do.
Nothing but a thing, Goon says, and gives Daddy dap. Him and his boys head back outside.
Are you serious right now?
Uncle Carlos yells.
You really think gangbangers can provide adequate security? They strapped, ain't they?
Daddy says.
Ridiculous.
Uncle Carlos looks at Mama.
Look, I'll go with you to the courthouse tomorrow, as long as they aren't coming too. Punk ass,
Daddy says.
Can't even protect your niece because you're scared of what it'll look like to your fellow cops if you're working with gangbangers. Oh, you want to go there, Maverick?
Uncle Carlos says. Carlos, calm down.
No, Lisa. I want to make sure I got this right. Does he mean the same niece I took care of while he was locked up, huh? The one I took to her first day of school because he took a charge for his so-called boy? The one I held when she cried for her daddy?
He's loud, and Mama stands in front of him to keep him from Daddy.
You can call me as many names as you want, Maverick, but don't you ever say I don't care about my niece and nephews. Yeah, that's right, nephews. 7-2. When you were locked up...
Carlos, Mama says.
No, he needs to hear this. When you were locked up, I helped Lisa every time your sorry-ass baby mama dropped 7 off on her, for weeks at a time. Me! I bought clothes, food, provided shelter. My Uncle Tom ass. Hell no, I don't want to work with criminals. But don't you ever insinuate I don't care about any of those kids.
Daddy's mouth makes a line. He's silent. Uncle Carlos snatches his keys off the coffee table, gives my forehead 2 pecks, and leaves. The front door slams shut. 19. The smell of hickory bacon and the sound of way too many voices wake me up. I blink to soothe my eyes from the assault my neon blue walls are giving them. It takes me a few minutes lying here to remember it's grand jury day. Time to see if I'll fail Khalil or not. I put my feet in my slippers and head toward the unfamiliar voices. 7 and Sakani are at school by now. Plus, their voices aren't that deep. I should be worried about some unknown dudes seeing me in my pajamas, but that's the beauty of sleeping in tanks and basketball shorts. They won't see much. The kitchen's standing room only. Guys in black slacks, white shirts, and ties are at the table or standing against the wall, shoveling food in their mouths. They have tattoos on their faces and hands. A couple of them give me quick nods and mumble, "Sup," through mouths full of food. The Cedar Grove King Lords. Damn, they clean up nicely. Mama and Aunt Pam work the stove as skillets full of bacon and eggs sizzle, blue flames dancing beneath them. Nana pours juice and coffee and runs her mouth. Mama barely looks over her shoulder and says, "Morning, Munch. Your plate's in the microwave. Come get these biscuits out for me, please." She and Aunt Pam move to the ends of the stove, stirring the eggs and turning the bacon. I grab a towel and open the oven. The aroma of buttery biscuits and a heat wave hit me head on. I pick up the pan with the towel, and that thing is still too hot to hold for long.
"Over here, little mama," Goon says at the table.
I'm glad to put it down. Not even 2 minutes after I set it on the table, every last biscuit is gone. God damn. I grab my paper towel-covered plate from the microwave before the King Lords inhale it, too. Star, get those other plates for your dad and your uncle, Aunt Pam says. Take them outside, please. Uncle Carlos is here? I tell Aunt Pam. Yes, ma'am. Stack their plates on top of mine, grab the hot sauce and some forks, and leave as Nana starts one of her back in my theater days stories. Outside, the sunlight's so bright it makes the paint on my walls seem dim. I squint and look around for Daddy or Uncle Carlos. The hatch on Daddy's Tahoe is up, and they're sitting on the back of it. My slippers scuff against the concrete, sounding like brooms sweeping the floor. Daddy looks around the truck. There go my baby. I hand him and Uncle Carlos a plate and get a kiss to the cheek from Daddy in return. You sleep okay? He asks. Kinda. Uncle Carlos moves his pistol from the space between them and pats the empty spot. Keep us company for a bit. I hop up next to them. We unwrap the plates that have enough biscuits, bacon, and eggs for a few people. I think this one's yours, Maverick, Uncle Carlos says. It's got turkey bacon. Thanks, man, Daddy says, and they exchange plates. I shake hot sauce on my eggs and pass Daddy the bottle. Uncle Carlos holds his hand out for it, too. Daddy smirks and passes it down. I would have thought you were too refined for some hot sauce on your eggs. You do realize this is the house I grew up in, right? He covers his eggs completely in hot sauce, sets the bottle down, and licks his fingers for the sauce that got on them. Don't tell Pam I ate all of this, though. She's always on me about watching my sodium. I won't tell if you won't tell, Daddy says. They bump fists to seal the deal. I woke up on another planet or in an alternate reality. Something. Y'all cool all of a sudden?
We talked, Daddy says. It's all good.
Yep, says Uncle Carlos.
Some things are more important than others.
I want details, but I won't get them. If they're good, though, I'm good. And honestly, it's about damn time. Since you and Aunt Pam are here, where's Devante? I ask Uncle Carlos.
At home, for once, and not playing video games with your little boyfriend.
Why does Chris always have to be little to you? I ask. He's not little.
You better be talking about his height, says Daddy. Amen, Uncle Carlos adds,
and they fist bump again. So they've found common complaining ground. Chris. Figures. Our street is quiet for the most part this morning. It usually is. The drama always comes from people who don't live here. Two houses down, Mrs. Lynn and Miss Carol talk in Mrs. Lynn's yard, probably gossiping. Can't tell either one of them anything if you don't want it spread around Garden Heights like a cold. Mrs. Pearl works in her flower bed across the street, with a little help from 40 ounce. Everybody calls him that, because he always asks for money to buy a 40 ounce from the liquor store real quick. His rusty shopping cart with all of his belongings is in Mrs. Pearl's driveway, a big bag of mulch on the bottom of it. Apparently he has a green thumb. He laughs at something Mrs. Pearl says, and people two streets over probably hear that guffaw of his.
Can't believe that fool's alive, Uncle Carlos says. Would have thought he drank himself to death by now.
Who? 40 ounce? I ask.
Yeah. He was around when I was a kid. Nah, he ain't going nowhere, says Daddy. He claims the liquor keeps him alive.
Does Mrs. Rooks live around the corner? Uncle Carlos asks. Yep, I say. And she still makes the best red velvet cakes you ever had in your life.
Wow. I told Pam I have yet to taste a red velvet cake as good as Mrs. Rook's. What about,
He snaps his fingers.
The man who fixed cars lived at the corner. Mr. Washington, says Daddy. Still kicking it and still does better work than any automotive shop around. Got his son helping him, too.
Lil John? Uncle Carlos asks. The one that played basketball but got on that stuff?
Yep, says Daddy. He been clean for a minute now.
Man. Uncle Carlos pushes his red eggs around his plate.
I almost miss living here sometimes.
I watch 40 Ounce help Mrs. Pearl. People around here don't have much, but they help each other out as best they can. It's this strange, dysfunctional-as-hell family. But it's still a family. More than I realized until recently.
Star?
Nana calls from the front door. People two streets over probably hear her like they heard 40 Ounce.
Your mama said hurry up. You gotta get ready. Hey, Pearl.
Mrs. Pearl shields her eyes and looks our way. Hey, Adele. Haven't seen you in a while. You all right?
Hanging in there, girl. You got that flower bed looking good. I'm coming by later to get some of that Birds of Paradise.
All right.
You not gonna say hey to me, Adele?
40 Ounce asks. When he talks, it jumbled together like one long word.
Hell no, you old fool,
Nana says. The door slams behind her. Daddy, Uncle Carlos, and I crack up. The Cedar Grove King Lords trail us in two cars, and Uncle Carlos drives me and my parents. One of his off-duty buddies occupies the passenger seat. Nana and Aunt Pam trail us, too. All these people, though, and none of them can go in the grand jury room with me. It takes 15 minutes to get to downtown from Garden Heights. There's always construction work going on for some new building. Garden Heights has dope boys on corners, but downtown, people in business suits wait for crossing lights to change. I wonder if they ever hear the gunshots and shit in my neighborhood. We turn onto the street where the courthouse is, and I have one of those weird deja vu moments. I'm 3, and Uncle Carlos drives Mama, 7, and me to the courthouse. Mama cries the entire drive, and I wish Daddy were here because he can always get her to stop crying. 7 and I hold Mama's hands as we walk into a courtroom. Some cops bring Daddy out in an orange jumpsuit. He can't hug us because he's handcuffed. I tell him I like his jumpsuit. Orange is one of my favorite colors. But he looks at me real seriously and says,
"Don't you ever wear this. You hear me?"
All I remember after that is the judge saying something, Mama sobbing, and Daddy telling us he loves us as the cops haul him off. For 3 years, I hated the courthouse because it took Daddy from us. I'm not thrilled to see it now. News vans and trucks are across the street from the courthouse, and police barricades separate them from everybody else. I now know why people call it a media circus. It seriously looks like the circus is setting up in town. 2 traffic lanes separate the courthouse from the media frenzy, but I swear they're a world away. Hundreds of people quietly kneel on the courthouse lawn. Men and women in clerical collars stand at the front of the crowd, their heads bowed. To avoid the clowns and their cameras, Uncle Carlos turns onto the street alongside the courthouse. We go in through the back door. Goon and another King Lord join us. They flank me and don't hesitate to let security check them for weapons. Another security guard leads us through the courthouse. The farther we go, the fewer people we pass in the halls. Ms. Ofra waits behind a door with a brass plate that says Grand Jury Room. She hugs me and asks,
"Ready?"
But once I am, "Yes, ma'am."
"I'll be out here the whole time," she says. "If you need to ask me something, you have that right."
She looks at my entourage.
"I'm sorry, but only Star's parents are allowed to watch in the TV room."
Uncle Carlos and Aunt Pam hug me. Nana pats my shoulder as she shakes her head. Goon and his boy give me quick nods and leave with them. Mama's eyes brim with tears. She pulls me into a tight hug, and it's at that moment, of all the moments, that I realize I've gotten an inch or two taller than she is. She plants kisses all over my face and hugs me again. I'm proud of you, baby. You are so brave. That word, I hate it. No, I'm not. Yeah, you are. She pulls back and pushes a strand of hair away from my face. I can't explain the look in her eyes, but it knows me better than I know myself. It wraps me up and warms me from the inside out. Brave doesn't mean you're not scared, Star, she says. It means you go on even though you're scared. And you're doing that. She leans up slightly on her tiptoes and kisses my forehead, as if that makes it true. For me, it kind of does. Daddy wraps his arms around both of us.
You got this, baby girl.
The door to the grand jury room creaks open, and the DA, Ms. Monroe, looks out. We're ready if you are. I walk into the grand jury room alone, but somehow my parents are with me. The room has wood-paneled walls and no windows. About 20 or so men and women occupy a U-shaped table. Some of them are black, some of them aren't. Their eyes follow us as Miss Monroe leads me to a table in front of them with a mic on it. One of Ms. Monroe's colleagues swears me in, and I promise on the Bible to tell the truth. I silently promise it to Khalil, too. Ms. Monroe says from the back of the room, Could you please introduce yourself to the grand jurors? I scoot closer to the mic and clear my throat. My small voice sounds like a 5-year-old's. I sit up straight and try again. My name is Star Carter. I'm 16 years old. The mic is only recording you, not projecting your voice, Ms. Monroe says. As we have our conversation, we need you to speak loud enough for everyone to hear, okay? Yes. My lips brush the mic. Too close. I move back and try again. Yes, ma'am. Good. You came here on your own free will, is that correct? Yes, ma'am. You have an attorney, Ms. April Ofra, correct? She says. Yes, ma'am. You understand you have the right to consult with her, correct? Yes, ma'am. You understand you're not the focus of any criminal charges, correct? Bullshit. Khalil and I have been on trial since he died. Yes, ma'am. Today, we want to hear in your own words what happened to Khalil Harris, okay? I look at the jurors, unable to read their faces and tell if they really want to hear my words. Hopefully they do. Yes, ma'am. Now, since we have that understanding, let's talk about Khalil. You were friends with him, right? I nod, but Ms. Monroe says, Please give a verbal response. I lean toward the mic and say, Yes, ma'am. Shit, I forgot the jurors can't hear me on it, and it's only for recording. It doesn't make any sense that I'm so nervous. How long did you know Khalil? The same story all over again. I become a robot who repeats how I knew Khalil since I was 3. How we grew up together, the kind of person he was. When I finish, Miss Monroe says, Okay, we're going to discuss the night of the shooting in detail. Are you okay with that? The unbrave part of me, which feels like most of me, shouts no. It wants to crawl up in a corner and act as if none of this ever happened. But all those people outside are praying for me. My parents are watching me. Khalil needs me. I straighten up and allow the tiny brave part of me to speak. Yes, ma'am.
Context of white supremacy. We will pick up there next week. So next week, we will be at the beginning of part 3 of the book and chapter 20.
for next Friday. I think we should have two more sessions of this book, and we will be all done. Thank heavens, thank heavens, thank heavens. Quickly, all of this talk about hot sauce, remember in 2016, presidential election, the candidate that took an L to the Donald when she was trying to make inroads with the Negro voters, and she was talking about how she kept hot sauce in her pocket. Maybe people don't remember that. That's so long ago, and who remembers losers anyway? But I remember when whites have been tacky with hot sauce before. Anywho, number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Everybody who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Please do not wait till the last minute. If you think you have commentary you would like to share, if you know you didn't get an opportunity to speak the first time around, you should definitely get a hand up right now so we can get to you early on. I think the caller is 7656. I don't think we heard from you first time around. Ma'am, did you have commentary you want to share with us?
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. I hope everyone is having the best evening they could have. To answer your question from the first half, no, this is not the book that I believe exemplifies the greatness or the wonderfulness of black femininity, black young adulthood in male or female form. I don't know what the author is trying to get other people to appreciate about black women or young black women. I mean, I guess the fact that through all this chaos, they're still alive. I mean, other than that, I don't know. I think this book is a good example of what Mr. Fuller says. If you don't understand racism, everything else will only confuse you. This young lady, I'm sure she's a wonderful person. She's, you know, I'm talking about the author, the real author. I'm sure she's lovely and all that, but as many of us don't understand racism, I think this is a clear example. If you don't understand racism, this is the product. And I was looking at something about her, and she grew up in the neighborhood where Mega Evers got shot, I guess her or her mom in that neighborhood, and it's weird that that happened to her. And in the book, she, you know, has a character who reaches out to have, a pseudo-sexual relationship with a white person. I know we talked about the Little Rock Nine going through the trauma they went through, and I think you said half of them ended up with white people. I don't know if knowing about this significant type of trauma or going through those times, if you end up with white people, you know, Serena Williams, I guess the same thing. I don't know about that. I guess she's coming out with another book about another 16-year-old who wants to be a rapper. That's coming out in June. So, oh Lord, look at, you know, get ready for, I don't know, the hoopla, whatever about that. And I think we talked about the food in the past. The food has come up again a lot. And it's just sad, and then even using the food as a weapon, you know, it's supposed to be a wonderful moment with the family watching basketball, but then they turn into a weaponized moment using unhealthy food. And then the conversation of Maverick when they moved to the house, again, you would think there was a little reprieve of happy moments for the family. They get a new home and all that stuff, but it's still tacky with the relationship with him. And then she brings up the prayer in the middle of prayer, almost starting a fight there. I just, you know, I have issues with that. I'm sure more people will have more thoughtful things to say, but those are the things that came to my mind. Oh, and one more thing. When she said she didn't want to testify because of all the, after the gunshots, that reminded me of the story, I think, Dr. Wilson told about a young man. She asked him, well, why don't you want to help black people? She said, well, if you try to help black people, you get killed. I was like, wow, I guess, you know, that came to my mind when that part was read. Thank you.
Appreciate that. All the other folks who dialed in with a hand up, I guess we'll get Ivy first since we haven't heard from her at all. Ivy, I got your back. If you had commentary, proceed.
Thank you, sir. I don't know if I got my own back. Man, that was a good one. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the listeners and callers in all the earth.
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Oh, okay, great. I want to say first that I that contest that Mr. Williams was running, I actually won that for the definition of racism. I'm trying to get to my quick notes here. Can you still hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'm trying to get up here. I've gotten to it. Man, what I noticed about this book is that there are a lot of sneak disses, like talking about I don't want to be seen as ghetto. That's just white people calling us ghetto. And then previously something about somebody being in B-mode, B-I-T-C-H mode, and then somebody being a wigger. That's just a sneak diss, just trying to call us a nigger. And this, or a nigger, this whole book is just a hit piece on black people in general. And I wanted to ask a quick question. Gus, wasn't there previously a dispute where a child was getting into it with their parent, and I believe it was a girl, and she was being disrespectful to both her parents or one of them?
I think there was some sort of disagreement. Star may have been involved. I don't think it was with her mom, but I think there was some sort of discord, and some profanity may have been used. I think even a listener had commented that there was some profanity used. A child, I think, was using some profanity where an adult was present, and there might have been some disagreement. I think that did happen previously.
Yes, I believe the previous caller, the previous woman who just spoke, mentioned that. So to answer your question about what white people or just anyone would think about black girls after reading this book, well, what I think they would think about them is that they are promiscuous and that they have disregard for their bodies, you know, just all this teenage sex and all of that, and that they are disrespectful to their parents and authority in general, that they're callous, and that they were just able to you know, really forget about Khalil. And even earlier in the book, it talked about how I think the person went back to school and it was said that nobody was talking about Khalil. I think it was Star saying that, I'm not for sure. Another thing that I think they would think is that, you know, black girls are closeted homosexuals, and that they worship white people. Just all this this worshiping of Chris, and just the other girl with the pixie cut, and just, you know, all this stuff. And so, yeah, that's what I think that they would think of black girls when you walk away from this book. And that's all I had. And thanks, everybody. And thanks, Gus. I'll meet my line.
Congratulations to Ivy. Mr. Edward Williams, contest definition for racism, white supremacy. Glad that was what he wanted, to see more people being motivated and thinking, sharing their ideas, views on racism. Congratulations. Other folks, anybody that we missed completely, anybody who we have not heard from at all who had commentary? Great. Okay, got everybody. All the other folks, if you dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have any comments that you would like to share, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Red in Nevada.
Thank you for taking my call again. The first thing I kind of want to comment on is maybe to add to the whole theory of there being a ghostwriter is the constant corny references to Harry Potter. I know as a child, my sister had to read it. I had to read it for school, like the Harry Potter series. But we didn't actually act out different Harry Potter scenes or anything like that. There was the term Voldemorted was used. And even back in the beginning of the book where they were like Natasha, Khalil, and Star, they were kind of like the Harry Potter characters. And even when they were running to the room
there was a reference made to Harry Potter and the Gauntlet of Fire. Just constant corny references. This is not something that I've ever heard black people say anything about. The LeBron part kind of got to me personally, because I remember where I was when he announced that he was going to Miami. But I guess that was only, maybe that was like the best part for me. I wouldn't say the best part, but at least it kind of brought a chuckle to me. The dairy part, at least, it seemed like for a brief moment, it maybe kind of understood or maybe said how horrible dairy actually is. I don't eat dairy. The interrupting of the prayer, once again, it just seems like there's this constant, like I said, torturing this black husband. And it's kind of like it also doesn't seem maybe real, at least maybe not real to me, that he would say after constantly having to keep making up for this. And even the part with the argument between him, Uncle Carlos and Maverick, it was just, you know, of course, black dysfunction on just dysfunction on display, but also yet another example of how this cannot be someone's favorite character if he's never allowed to say anything. He just, his mouth was just in a line and he didn't say anything. And it's like, it was only 3 years. They're kind of keep bringing this up as if he was in jail for 10 years and he's more than made up, I'm assuming, because, you know, doing the math, he was in Star's life for 13 years of the 16 that she was alive. So it's unfathomable that he would have to keep making up for the 3 years that he was gone. The parts that I find are, it seems like it's repetitious, is that whenever Star's parents, they show some type of affection, there's kind of like this little joke where Star's like, oh, I can't stand it. Oh, it's so cute. I'm so bothered by it. But it's like, it's not really that way. If it's, her showing affection to Chris, I think there was maybe like one time where she might have said how cute Chris was, the whole worshiping whiteness or worshiping this white male. And maybe she could have said, I can't stand it. But it almost seems like every time there's some type of affection shown between her parents, there's always like this, like, oh, I hate it. So you can't even love black love, especially for your parents. The 40 ounce, it's just ridiculous. Just ridiculous. The fist pumping seems like something a corny white person would do. And then like even the names of the parts, like part two is 5 weeks after it. And then before, I think it was before 16. Well, that's actually the one that's before 16 and then 8 weeks after it. And it's kind of going against what the author said in the beginning commentary that, you know, they want, you know, black females, if something were to happen to them, being shot by the police or whatever, their names aren't actually brought up. But then I kind of feel like it's somewhat the same way when it comes to the naming of the parts after it, not after the death of Khalil or the murder of Khalil. It's just after it, taking away his name. The last thing, actually two more things. When the whole gunshot scene happened, for a slight second, I was thinking, you know, it could be a gangbangers, but then I immediately started thinking, okay, well, it could be the cops as well. So I definitely appreciate, you know, at least Crazy Maverick's input about that. And the last thing, I do agree with, I think that was Ivy, or maybe the other female caller, when she was talking about how this book may make young black females appear to be homosexual. And I've actually been told that by a couple of different non-white males that, well, you know, all or most females, and I guess we're kind of referencing black females, are you know, somewhat seeking homosexuality or not opposed of it, which I thought was crazy. But it's, you know, it's, I guess it kind of goes along with what the racist white supremacists are putting in our faces and all different types of media. I'll leave it there, and thank you for allowing me to share.
Indeed. Other folks that we have not heard from, or other folks who have commentary, period, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
I'll be heard.
Can I be heard?
Let's get...
Go ahead, Mr. Thomas, go ahead.
Sir, I deflect to you. You go first, Mr. Firefighter.
Thank you, sir. I thought the writer, whoever it was, made a mockery out of several people who actually lost their lives attempting to dismantle the system of racist white supremacy with the surface like understanding of the Black Panther Party 10-point program and basically stating that all Huey P. Newton was a crackhead, you know, that sort of thing, and the whole idea of Malcolm X being shot by black people. I mean, it would have been all right if he was just shot by white people, you know what I mean? You know, just made a mockery out of it, which is sweet music to white people's ears to hear that sort of commentary on such on something actually what young non-white people should be studying instead of this particular type of book. They need to be studying not only from a surface of the 10-point program, but actually attempting to live it, you know, as far as that concern, as well as the attempts that Malik Shabazz attempted to do, that basically just made mockery out of it. From that standpoint, whoever the writer, like I said, whoever the writer was, if it was a non-white person, then it shows a tremendous level of anti-blackness. And of course, if it was a white person, we know where that comes from. That's basically is a act of racist white supremacy. And something like this book, as I mentioned before, could be a very, very, a very effective weapon, I will call it, to confuse the non-white black young people that apparently are forced to read this book. I would hate to have been a teacher and be confronted with having to is that my phone?
Let's see, retired firefighter.
I'm here.
Oh, okay. No, it was not your line. Someone else's line. I think that caller at 4683 sounds like there might be some distortion on your line. I'll open your line back up a little later and check it again. Sorry about that, retired firefighter.
That's all right. That's okay. That's what I thought about. Thought about that aspect in the book. I really think that the previous female callers were very much accurate in their analysis of the book, being that they are non-white black females, and on top of it are less confused, and so they have a very constructive critical analysis of what this book is saying, and I'm going to keep paying attention to what they have to say, and everybody else. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Thomas in New York.
Good evening again. Good evening to all the callers who just called in and all everyone who also spoke. I'm glad the firefighter just spoke because it brought back something I wanted to mention before. So let me explain. I sent you the... You read some of the questions from that test. I had a hard time seeing them. But how it works at my kids, well, my children's school, is called ELA. You know, I know that LA means English Language Arts, I believe, is the testing. So they get a whole bunch, it's probably 1,000 books, and they give them a level from A to Z. And based off the level of your kids, your child's reading, that's how they get that book selected for them. So all of my children have been level B, which means that they read on a college level. Since they were in like the fifth grade, because I mean they have to read hundreds of books. I mean they read way better than me. So what happens is the teachers never read these books. They just have to administer a test, and the test might have 10 questions, and it's just to prove that the kid read the child read the book, and the child's comprehension of what they read was on point. And as they pass these tests and prove that they read the books, they move up to the next grade level. So that's how they go from, you know, second grade reading level, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. I hope that explained it. So those are the type of questions that I guess they would get asked on a test. Of course, they do this at school. It's done on a computer. It's not even their teacher that administers it. It's like a reading aid that they go into a little room and the questions come up on the computer. They do the little question in 10 minutes, and that's it. The test is over, and they move up as they finish the books. This is trash. This is worse than mumble rap, you know, or trap rap. This is worse than reality TV, okay? This book is a comedy to white people. They read this book, and they probably go and pop in Soul Plane or something. I mean, it's gotten to that level. I'm glad the caller read about the food, because I made a reference to that. Every scene, every reading is some food, and it's never healthy food. It's just, it started off with Pop-Tarts and, what was the other thing they was eating? Sour Patch Kids. And, I mean, just tacky food and everything about it. I'm going to contrast the parties. See, white people need constant reinforcement that they are better than us. Their whole society and every aspect of it, especially history, is built on theories and scientifically teach white people and train black people that white people are better, white people are smarter, and therefore they're entitled to rule. So the Black Party, it was all about white fashion, white people sneaker brands like Jordan. Her friend was there, but she's trying to fight another girl over a boy, and somehow she just leaves her. A young man gets killed at the party. They leave the party. Another young black man gets killed by the police. The first young black man got killed by another young black man. However, they did some excellent dancing at this party. At the white party, people could have problems like calling her girlfriends, but there's no fighting. There's no arguing. People look handsome. They look nice. There's no talk about their name brand clothing, even though she did mention a pair of Converses, I believe. Still, it's no fighting. It's, everyone's getting along. Everyone's dancing. They're fist pumping. Even though they can't dance, no one gets judged or ashamed by their terrible dancing. A boyfriend could serenade his girlfriend with the Fresh Prince theme song, and everyone goes home and gets home safe. And it was a great party. It's just contrast to how this whole society runs. Constant dysfunction. It sounds like they moved from a bad ghetto to a nice ghetto. When they said there was a bunch of black people living around them, I mean, I once heard a black white person say, man, once you got, three or four black people on your block, you got a ghetto. So seems like they just moved up a little bit, people that get paid more money. Her father swallowed his pride to protect his children. Finally, you know, this is a man who's keeping it real. But your daughter done lost her two best friends to street violence, and you keeping it real. I mean, you own your own business. It just doesn't make logical sense, and I don't see how this is her favorite character. But I think this is how they want the black man to be, and it has a lot to do with my theory on why the black women are being attacked. They want the black man to be very submissive. And that's what he keeps doing. Even though he's a hard rock, the new feminist movement is all about white women coming into power and having a black man. And I don't know how people aren't seeing that one. So he's an aggressive black man, but he's still in control, even though it's a black woman doing it. I keep equating him to, like, LeVar Ball, you know, but either way. The last thing I wanted to say is I can't wait for my kids to tell me that they started reading these books, because I'm going to have some, you know, very good conversations, because they pick up on things normally I don't. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
We'll love that as well. It'll be great to hear their commentary when they have to read this abomination. Other folks have commentary. We've not heard from, if you dialed in with a hand up.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Is that Jay in St. Louis?
Yeah, this is Jay from St. Louis. Can you hear me clearly? Am I kind of muffled? Or?
You're good.
Cool. Took some notes for this second section. I just want to thank all the callers. This is the first time this week I've been able to hear voices that sound like mine and not be the only person in the room. Sorry for the metaphor, but it's great to hear other people who think seriously. So some things I took down was the materialism and the kind of gluttony that was at the basis of Star's evaluation of her parents being cute. It was all kind of disgusting and gluttonous for me. And it was wrapped in food terrorism, which another caller brought up. These pop cultural ways of relating to each other through the basketball game and the NBA finals and all of it. I think that stuff does more to dehumanize this family than actually humanize them, because it kind of takes away from communicating the supposed urgency of their situation. And then one other thing I noted was that I think that these characters are the most apolitical people I've ever read about. They're just very apolitical, not very politically savvy. They even do a straw man of Maverick and the other black heroes who sacrificed their lives to stop white supremacy. They paint them as dated, outdated, and just people who died and didn't think about the consequences and crackheads. And to answer the question you posed earlier, Gus, I think if I was white and I read this book, I would feel so validated. I think this book validates the old British civilizing mission way back in the day. It's amazing how that same logic is just validated throughout this book. I would feel like I have a perfect victim, a young, naive victim who already hates radical blackness. It's perfect. I think this book is just a logical outcome of black feminism, and it's here to sow deceit and disorganization, and that's all this book embodies to me. Racial hit piece indeed. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Jay in St. Louis. Any other folks have a hand up? Make sure we don't miss anybody. If you dialed in, you have a hand up, we will give you your opportunity to share your thoughts. Did we miss anyone? Anybody have a hand up, commentary?
Hey, I could be heard right quick.
Yes, sir.
Hey, man. Hey, I just want to say hello to everybody, man. Hey, excuse me. I got to agree with Thomas, man. This book is garbage. And now, I remember, I think on the first go-round, I think this is supposed to be in the schools, like the white people making the kids read this in the school, and that just go to show that, hey, people really don't need to be sending their children to white people's schools, man. I mean, but then to say that, also to say that it really ain't nothing you gonna learn from white people. Now, I don't know if this, I'm somebody that used to read, I think they call them urban novels, Now, I don't know. I think it might have been said that this lady was black or this officer was black or non-white. But I don't know. But this, I don't think this was a black person that wrote this book. You know, being somebody that's been read a lot of black novels, this is not no, this don't sound right. Excuse me, man, but this book here is crazy, man. And it's like, imagine a little fourth grade kids, you know, they end up, you know, and white people can manipulate the mind real good, you know. But I say that because, see, I don't like dealing with white people, period, on anything. You know what I mean? Because you ain't going to get it. You ain't going to get it what you really looking for. You see what I'm saying? So I just think that it's better for black people to deal with each other and learn from each other. And the children need to learn from, you know, people that, they elders, you know, and they're going, you know, but, but yeah, hey man, thank you. And I'm going to mute my line right there.
Appreciate that down in Texas. Appreciate that. Stay safe, sir. Anybody else that we missed have commentary? Anybody else have commentary on the second audio segment that they wanted to share? We get everybody.
Can I add? I'm sorry. Can I add something?
Let's hear it right in the bottom.
The one thing, I know somebody else already mentioned it, but it was the, I guess somebody called it sneak dissing, which I agree. Try not to use metaphors, even though I know this isn't Saturday, but the part where they call Huey P. Newton, Dr. Huey P. Newton, he died a crackhead, and I've never heard of that. Maybe because I know that I'm just now really starting to read and try to be more aware of my surroundings. I don't really like, I hate the word conscious, but it just seems like for them to introduce it, like for them to actually really, you know, like someone else said, you know, keep referencing the Black Panthers and then to go back and say, well, you know, he died a crackhead. And if somebody, and of course, if this is being taught to black children, then that's another detrimental part on top of the fact that, you know, all the different tragic arrangements. I just wanted to add that. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
Great point. And particularly, this is a young adult novel. We had a caller on workplace racism yesterday dial in and said that he was an educator. He said that sixth through eighth graders were reading this book, which means you got 11-year-olds reading this book with white female teachers, no less. Just think about that. But I'm sure they don't have extensive knowledge of COINTELPRO and J. Edgar Hoover and the Black Panther Party and how they were terrorized for years in the 1960s and 70s and beyond. I'm sure they have no understanding of that information at all. So this might be the first time that they're hearing of Huey P. Newton and the Black Panther Party, and their first bit of information is 10-point program by some crackheads. Got it. That's the Black Panther Party. First introduction. Might as well have just went to see the movie and, you know, forget about these hoodlum crackheads, you know. And that is accurate, unless I've been misinformed. Huey P. Newton at the time of his death, where he was shot and killed under suspicious circumstances, and I believe that was also an anniversary killing. Folks want to check suspected race soldier John Patash, his book, The FBI's War Against Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, the very person who allegedly influenced this book. He has a whole section talking about Huey P. Newton and saying, yes, he was having a substance abuse issue towards the end of his life. However, that was a big part of the COINTELPRO program. And in fact, I can broaden that repeatedly in the book. I felt the section where she chided Maverick and the other Negroes in the house for smoking cigarettes, and that contributed to her asthma. Whites are to blame for that. 40 ounce. Oh, my God. You talk about a deplorable. I'm supposed to feel good about black females reading about 40 ounce. Yes. At any rate, the reason that you have 40 ounce and a house full of black people smoking cigarettes is because of racist man, racist woman, racist child. We've done whole programs about how whites strategically, deliberately
put cigarettes all around black people so that they can get lung cancer and asthma and all kinds of health problems, deliberately put alcohol and all kinds of poisons all around black people, deliberately, not yoga studios, so you can be healthy and in great shape. All of this is racist, man, but that's not being indicted. And the same thing with the Black Panther Party. That's not being explained. Yes, we targeted these Negroes. We tried to do everything we could to eliminate them. Killings, beatings, lies, jailings, drugs, any and everything, cigarettes and everything. All of that just gets distilled down to he's a crackhead. And, yeah, for an even 11-year-olds, for a lot of 40-year-olds, for a lot of 50-year-olds, that would be enough to permanently damage any association with the Black Panther Party. Quick notes that I wanted to get in. The section where Maverick, I guess, is saying, you know, he's agreeable to moving out of Garden Heights into a better, quote-unquote, ghetto. And she says, or it's written in the text, Mama questions Maverick like he's being grilled in front of the class again. This is Maverick. His name allegedly means, the definition of Maverick is an unorthodox or independent-minded person, allegedly. But he is a child being dressed down repeatedly in this book by everybody, almost never listened to, no opinion of value, just metaphor, great metaphor. I think Harry Potter, we talked about contrast programs, contrast programming, Dr. Welsing. Contrast Harry Potter, that young adult novel, with this one. Wow. Book for young white boys and girls to read, admire, look up to. You don't have filth and drug addicts and crackheads on every other page. This is our young adult novel for a movie. Wow. We'd love to hear Dr. Welsing's thoughts on that. We got a Black Jesus reference again. Even the Always Got Your Back. That just seems so tacky and cliche to hear it over and over. It's on almost every other page. I got your back. Got your back, Star. Got your back, Thomas. Got your back, Mr. Dibriano. I mean, I don't know black people that use that many cliches every other sentence when they talk. I thought the whole interruption of the prayer at the dinner, ugh, super tacky. And I don't know very many black people who where that would be written in. We're going to interrupt the prayer to have a fight where this is not a joke. This is something where we've already had serious conflict about our living situation and whether we're going to move out or what have you. Let's see. Yeah, I agree completely. Where Uncle Carlos, where he rips into Maverick again, tortured. I thought that was great employment of that term. That's exactly what it seems like to me. And again, just keeping in mind every time that these scenes happens, where we have to be reminded of him being a convict and you weren't there to take care of your children and your little bastard children from your affair with this sex worker, you weren't here to take care, all of these reminders and what have. This is the favorite character in the book of the author, allegedly. From the last chapter, we already got the Huey P. Newton part. When Uncle Carlos, when he says that he doesn't want to work with criminals, I didn't know whether to laugh or to just highlight, you work for the police. I thought you worked with 115, who just killed an unarmed black person. You work with the biggest criminal syndicate in the universe. I think I can leave it there. I'm a wrap for the week. Terrible book. We'll be glad when it's done. Contrast programming on so many levels, even Chris's interruptions for sexual intercourse. In my view, that is a substantially greater conflict in this book than Khalil. As we have moved on, Khalil and his death has receded to the – that just gets referenced as it. It that happened 5 weeks ago, it that happened 8 weeks ago. The sexual activity with Chris, that seems to be a much more important central conflict in the book than Khalil and what's going to, because I feel like we already know what's going to happen there. 115 is not going to be, you know, charged or whatever, and boo-hoo, moving on. The real interest will be what happens with Chris and the romance, I think, but, you know, we'll see. With that, we will wrap. I think we have two sessions left. Hopefully it will not go beyond two, then we'll be done. We can move on to a new book. We'll be here for the compensatory call-in tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. I am not enjoying this book, The Hate U Give. However, this is an important investment of time. With France Fanon, Black Skin White, or excuse me, we read The Wretched of the Earth. I didn't like any of the books I've read of his. That I didn't enjoy, and I did not think it was a constructive investment of time. This, I do think, is a constructive investment of time because you have millions of children reading this book. Maybe, just maybe, one of them, five of them, might stumble on the archives as they're writing their report or reading about this and they do some searching online. Maybe they might find this and become less confused. Anywho, we'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in. We'll be here next Friday as we continue to move through The Hate U Give. Thanks so much to everyone tuning in with a little bit over time, but we had, you know, lots of participation and so much anti-blackness, so much to say. If you have additional thoughts, you can write in untiljustice@gmail.com. I will happily read your comments on the air over the next 2 weeks, hopefully just 2 weeks. If you have any other thoughts, anything got left out, things that you just want to make sure get shared, feel free to drop an email. If you have guest suggestions, book suggestions, you can write that as well. It is the weekend, warmer weather. Folks are getting close to being done with school and all that. Have fun. However, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Lord knows we heard enough about crackheads and 40 ounces for one day. This is what whites think about us anyway. This will be the justification anyway. Fit the profile of a crackhead, alcoholic, both, whatever it is. Let's do everything we can to preserve our brain computer so we can make great decisions, accurately understand what's happening around us, and solve this problem so we don't have to be bombarded with this sort of terrorist literature anymore. Sobriety would be best, especially if you're going to be out and about in a vehicle, driver, or passenger. Buckle up. Sobriety would be best. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no, 115 or Chris, all the same thing. We need to minimize contact with all of them. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.